I'm so hype right now. Anything's possible. Anything's possible!
RSD Renegade Radio. Where real guys talk real sports. Allow me to introduce the illustrious three-man booth.
I want winners.
What's your name, boy?
Watch the game changer.
What's your name, boy?
D-Well.
Now, ladies and gentlemen.
CLT Sports PhD.
The world famous.
Ray.
They are who we thought they were.
We need more dollars.
RSG Renegade Radio. The plug is about to open.
Everybody has an opinion.
A man must have a code.
We're taking RSG to the next level.
Hello. You play to win the game.
You could gripe about Mike's game, but I don't see shooting percentage getting it.
I mean, I'm not griping the third overall player on my list.
Is it safe?
Now, I blame it on Nintendo.
It's provocative.
Because we don't make excuses. You know, we're not going to make any excuses.
You need to move more like a dog. We don't need a bunch of cats in here. Yeah, looking in the mirror. Do I look good? I got my extra bands on. I got my other shoes. Oh, be a dog. Can't wait. Can you dig it, sucker?
Welcome to the Real Sports Guys. Where real guys talk real sports. This is a guy in the lead seat, D. Wills. We're going to be working with a two-man booth here to start out with. The Game Changer will be joining us later in the show. But before I get into our rundown, I want to give Filthy Sports. How you doing, brother?
I'm doing good. I'm enjoying the NBA playoffs. Christmas has come early. I'm looking forward to the second round and these first-round matchups closing down. I'm really excited about the show we got. I'm firmly, D. Wills, I am firmly in the passenger side seat, your master navigator with the GPS here to answer any questions, okay? To keep you awake, to keep you up, I'm here, okay? In the passenger side seat for you, my man.
It's like that long trip I just took to Alabama. You need that person in that passenger side seat to kind of keep you going late at night. When you're at hour 12 of a 16-hour road trip, you need that person who just keeps talking. They understand their role.
Right.
I'm glad to have you in that seat. I wouldn't have anyone else in that seat. I know you're going to make sure that we stay the course. So I love that. But you hit something, though, that NBA, it's like the spring classic we've been calling it. It sounds like you've been enjoying it. We got a good show to talk about with that. So I'm excited about them. Excited about who we're going to have on the show today. And actually, you know, as usual, I'm excited to have you sit next to me on the show. So snap your seatbelt up, brother. We're gonna have a good
That's
one.
That's right.
You in tight? You got the block? Do I need to get the towel
locked
for you?
Okay. I'm ready. I got my 44-ounce big gulp drink. It's all loaded up, okay, with Gatorade and ice, okay. I've used the bathroom. There will be no stops on my behalf. I've got it loaded up, the GPS. I've got your music. See, that's the thing some people don't get, D-Wills. When I'm driving, okay, it is getting late, okay, I've been behind the wheel for 4 or 5 hours, and it's time for that next CD to come in. Select something that you know I'm going to like. Put something
right.
in that the driver's gonna like. Don't
That's
pick
right.
what you want to go with, okay? Because you got to keep the driver engaged. So I got your favorite CD now, D. Wills. What would that CD be for you? That CD that I need to have loaded up.
Wow, I tell you,
yes.
What would get me going just right is some old DOC. If I can just can do that, something that would just keep me rocking, something like that. So DOC would do it for me. You know, that, because sometimes you need that thing that's like, oh, that's my song. Or, you know, in the spirit of Adam Young, you know, some Beastie Boys, you know, something that would just take you back to a time when you were innocent.
That's right.
Rough times of the trips. That would work with me. I need something, though, that's got to get me moving, or my eyes will start going to sleep. So I need something like that to make my head bob. That's what my daughter said. My daughter said, I can tell when you're tired, Dad, when you're driving. You start singing this word, and your head starts bobbing. And that keeps it going. So if you give me something like that, I would be in the mix. I would be in the mix. Well, we got a great show tonight. I'm as excited as everything, you know, on the anniversary of the famous rant of practice. Everybody was talking about this week with Allen Iverson. We got a lot of stuff. We're going to be talking about a lot of playoff basketball and everything else. But I think before we get there, I'm going to, you know, shortly, I'm going to go off the dome a little bit. I rarely take a moment where I just kind of, you know, as Phil said, he's going to be in that passenger side. But I'm going to drive for a little while. I'm going to talk. I got some stuff that's been on my mind. And so I'm going to take a little bit of time to get that off my chest. And I'm going to take a little bit. I'm just going to go off the dome a little bit. I'm going to take one of our off the dome segments, and I'm going to get into some things. You know, I'm going to talk a little bit about Junior Seau and, you know, what he's meant, but, you know, what spawned as a result of his death, because we haven't really had a chance to get into that. But I got some stuff I want to say about that. I want to get into what people have been saying about Kurt Warner. I got some opinions about that. I want to talk about what's happened with these NFL suspensions and all the stuff that's going around that. There's a lot I want to cover, so I'm going to go off the dome a little bit. But then we're going to switch gears, and we're going to bring in Dr. Alan Sack, author of Counterfeit Amateurs. He's a current president of the Drake Group, which are a group of faculty and staff. People are dedicated to the mission of higher education and what's happening with student-athletes are really talking about the fact that we need to make some changes about what's happening with their experience. And so we look forward to having him on, and we're going to spend some time getting deep. That's one thing about the Real Sports Guys. You know, we are always looking at the context of sports, and we're looking at politics. We look at all the different aspects of sports. And so, you know, I'll be working that a little bit with him. Phil will be there. You know, he'll get off the passenger side at some point. We're going to put him in the driver's seat on that one. But we're both going to really talk to Dr. Sack about this. There's been a lot of interesting things happening lately, and I'm certain he has an opinion on it. And then we're going to go into Funky Editorial. Now, I had an incredible exchange with the Game Changer's wife on Facebook this weekend. We have Mayweather Cotto, and those of you who've been watching, listening to the show, have a true sense that, you know, in Flowers family that there isn't a lot of love for Floyd Mayweather. And I had a debate, and our very own Phil T, sports PhD, knows how fierce Marissa can be. She beat him in the finals.
Absolutely.
In fantasy basketball. She doesn't miss words. I said, describe her. She's like MC Light and Jay-Z. Got to be very careful. But we had a spirited debate about Mayweather and Cotto, and we're going to really get into that. And hopefully Game Changer will be here to connect with us as well. And hopefully we'll get some of y'all to engage us as well. We'll tell you how you can do that. Then we're going to go five on the black end side. We're going to have Justin Page. Now, Justin, as y'all know, he came on the show when we were doing our top 50 in the NBA, and he was the reason why we had to buy a pet. We had to buy a white pit bull named Cocaine. But this guy has been incredible since his first visit with us. He's our NBA analyst. Those of you who heard him come on here at the beginning of the playoffs, he had some incredible observations. We're excited about having him back tonight with us. And I just hope we don't have to bring the dog out when he's there. But he's going to say some interesting things. We're looking forward to what's happening with his impressions of what's been going on in the NBA. Then we're going to go into the Resistance Digital Dog of the Week and really hit that. Then we'll hit the shutdown. And then we'll do some previewing of what we have. We have a special gift. You know, PhD lays this out. He's like, he's not just a pastor side guy. He's that cook in the back. We send him in the back. He's like that chemist. We got a special show for y'all next week that we're going to lay out. And PhD will talk about that. And then, you know, we're going to shut the show down. And then we're going to after hours. And after hours, we're really going to get it. Bryce Harper. Y'all know about the young phenom. He got hit in the back by Hamels. And everybody's talking about, you know, the hypocrisy of baseball, but we'll get into that with that. We'll talk about Tiger. He missed the cut. What's happening? He's on the rise. And then Ohio State loses their top recruit due to a sex offender's pitcher, a scandal. And what's going on with that? We'll get into a little bit about that. So we got a full show tonight. You know, we want to invite you to connect with us. How do you connect with us? We're on Twitter. You go to twitter.com/realsportsguys. You can go to facebook.com/realsportsguysradio. Or you can just go to realsportsguys.com. You can connect to us on Twitter or Facebook by doing that. You can also call into the show. And said about doing that, the 347-989-0844. Excuse me, 347-989-0844. So let me off the dome for a few minutes here to kind of really set the stage. You know, Junior Seau passed away on May 2nd. You know, this is, you know, one of the greatest linebackers to play in the game. You know, he's on the all 1990s, all decade team. Incredible player, you know, tragically took his life. And there's been a lot of conversations about, you know, what's going on. Raised a lot of questions about what's happening with football, about concussions, about, you know, football players being able to make that transition to the real world and all the challenges that come along with that. Kurt Warner, you know, set off a storm because he said that he wouldn't let he's thinking about not letting his kids play football. You have reactions from people like Armani Toomer and others, Merrill Hodge, who said that Kurt Warner was in the wrong for saying what he said. And I really have a problem with that. We spend so much time talking about, you know, athletes not caring about certain things. You know, Kurt Warner, his road to fame was much different than most football players. He had a lot of stops along the way. You know, he worked, you know, bagging groceries, played in arena football. When you have that type of experience, you gain perspective. He's a very spiritual man. He has a lot that kind of governs his life. And what I heard from him is what I actually expected him to say. And in a time when we need more of our athletes to speak out and speak up, we have this reaction. And it's not Kurt Warner's fault. It's up to the game to be able to defend itself. Kurt should be able to say what he needs to say. He should be able to raise his kids the way he wants to raise them. And he didn't say, and in some ways he agreed with Merle and Armani about the fact that football can be a safe game if coached well. But as many of us know, it's hard to get a handle on youth football. It's hard to get a handle on how they coach football in middle school. It's hard to get a handle on all these things. And parents need to make informed decisions. Football is a violent game. You can't legislate violence. You can help players use better technique. You can do all that. But as long as these players are getting bigger, faster, and stronger, you're not going to be able to keep folks from getting injured. These guys are just too big, too fast, too athletic. And no matter how they collide, there's possibility of injury. And that comes along with the territory. You have to enter the game understanding that. We have a culture in football where you do not get rewarded for looking out and taking care of yourself. In some ways, you get shunned if you don't do the right thing or if you don't sacrifice for the team. And so that's something that football either has to live with or die with. And football has bigger problems. And some of it will be some of the stuff we'll talk about today with Dr. Sack. But football has incredible problems because the issues we have to deal with football players have to happen long before they show up on our field. You know, they have to happen when we have them as young people in college, helping them gain perspective. That's when we have to deal with that. And we have too many of our players today who are ending up in bankruptcy. 78% of players end up in bankruptcy within 2 years of retiring from football. 90% of football players who make $15 million or more end up in bankruptcy. So we have got to stop thinking about solutions that actually focus on money. We got to start thinking about solutions that help to build the capacity of these individuals to embrace the challenges of life and to have skills that really impact them lifelong. That's what we need to be doing with these folks, so that when they transition out of the game, they have the capacity to deal with all the challenges that come along with dealing with life when the child is not screaming anymore. And that's what our next guest is really going to help us get a handle on. How do we impact these folks when we have them on our college campuses? How do we create an experience where they can begin to explore and think about the things that are more lifelong learning opportunities? You know, Dr. Sack was on with us back in, I believe, in January. And we had a really great conversation with him about some of these issues. He is now taking the president's role of the Drake Group, which is a group of faculty and staff who have set their mission to really protect the integrity of the educational experience in higher education, and particularly focusing on what's happening with athletes. And I am excited about the kind of conversation we can have, because I think the things that we've learned from the experiences with Junior Seau, the things that we're talking about in terms of the transitions that these athletes have to make back to the real world and real life, I think start much earlier than their first game in the NFL. And so without further ado, I'd like to invite our special guest into the show, Dr. Alan Sack.
Well, thanks
a lot. How are you doing, Dr. Sack? How's it going?
Hi. I'm doing great, and things are going very, very well.
Well, you know, one of the things I was just talking about, and we definitely want to get into the mission and the work that you're doing right now, but, you know, I just, you know, talked about, because, you know, so much of what folks talk about is, you know, the potential, particularly in the revenue-generating sports, the potential what these athletes can make. And the recent statistics that have been talked about with folks playing in the NFL, where, you know, 78% of them are bankrupt after 2 years of leaving the sport. And the one that got me is 90% of the folks who make $15 million or more end up in bankruptcy.
What is
your reaction to that?
It's striking, not surprising. And I heard your comments, and I would add a little that it doesn't start in college. It starts before they even get into college, certainly maybe even elementary school, with many young athletes. And perhaps it's more likely to be the case with young African Americans. We've got a case of misplaced priorities. And from a very early age, the role models that a lot of these young men and women are seeing tend to be athletes. And that's nice. And every young, I guess every man, every young kid that I knew, And not women as much when I was young, but when I was younger, every friend I had dreamed about being in the NFL or playing professional baseball. But I think that for many young black Americans in particular, the people that they identify with almost primarily happen to be athletes, star athletes, who are out there just seemingly living a life of luxury and the way they're depicted in the media. And I think we talked about this the last time I was on, but people like Arthur Ashe, the great black tennis player, and Alan Page, my friend from Notre Dame, and now the Associate Justice of the Supreme Court in Minnesota, take the position that, yeah, sports are fine, but at a certain point you've got to turn away from sports and start thinking more about being in the Congress and being a doctor and being a professional, being a Barack Obama rather than a Michael Jordan. Nothing wrong with Michael Jordan. Great guy. I love him. Great role model in many ways. But if you start your life off trying to become a Michael Jordan, I think you end up getting a fairly narrow skill set. And Michael Jordan made it out very well, but not very many young African-Americans or non-African-Americans are going to end up being professional athletes. But if you start off with your life trying to be Barack Obama, and your chances of being Barack Obama are just as poor as they are of being the president as being Michael Jordan. But if you don't make the president in the process of trying to be president, you're developing a broad variety of skill sets. Now, you're learning about politics. You're learning how to read, to write, to carry yourself in so many different ways. There are lessons you learn from sports, but they tend to be more narrow. You learn it, maybe it reinforces competitiveness and other things, which are fine. But when you end up that you don't be Barack Obama, you've got this whole set of kind of things that you've learned from your education and in the classrooms and every other way that you can become that legislator, you can become that corporate executive. And so that's what bothers me about the way that we the kind of images we put in front of youth and the tremendously powerful impact I think it happens to have on young African-Americans, because there are not enough Barack Obamas out there. And so therefore they're misdirected in terms of priorities. Football is everything. And they oftentimes choose their school on the basis of the athletic experience they're going to have rather than in terms of the academic experience that they're going to have. And that leads into, I'm sure, many of the kind of questions that you have to ask tonight.
And I would say that, you know, and it's also about how we elevate the folks who are doing well out there, who are doing things that I would say are Barack-like or excelling in other fields. We don't do enough to elevate those folks who are doing it. So I think you hit it. And even on our show, since we've had you on it, we've had, Todd Duckett, who played in the NFL, who has a much broader perspective. We don't even talk about the athlete that we depict in terms of the multiple interests that they have. Someone like Shaq, who just completed the doctoral program. And so things that we know about some of these, those are even aspects of the athletes who are in front of us, who do some other things. We don't even elevate some of the other things that they do. And so I'd love to get into that. You know, I was thinking about the mission. You sent me the mission of the Drake Group, and I want to start with this. The word academic integrity shows up a lot.
Yeah.
In your mission, it shows up in your vision. Can you talk about what you mean by academic integrity?
Well, it's a little more complicated than what it appears to be in that one mission statement.
Yeah.
Academic integrity can involve any number of levels. The one that a lot of the American public would think about immediately, I think the stereotype, is a bunch of athletes who are just cheating their way through school, who are drinking, who are engaged in date rape, so on and so forth, and engaging in academic fraud. Well, that does occur, and striking example just took place down at the University of North Carolina, I think, where there are a whole series of revelations about academic fraud on that campus, and they involve a lot of athletes who are trying to find a quick way through school by attending classes that were, not real classes at all, no real professors. The other side of this thing is the responsibility of the university. So I had a tendency to put more of my emphasis on the adults, the professionals, the college presidents, the deans, the faculty, the people who create the curriculum, the people on the faculty senates. These people are responsible for much of the academic fraud because they allow for the emergence of, they keep the faculty who are these phantom faculty, the ones who are the, the friendly faculty, quote unquote, who are just allowing these athletes to get through without really making demands on them. The coaches who are driving the athletes to such a degree they have very little time really left but to try to find a tutor who will write a paper for them. So it's a more complicated issue, this idea of academic integrity. There's a whole series of people involved. I tend to think that we have to really start looking at the institution and its responsibility to begin with, and then we can start talking more about the athletes who have to take responsibility for their behavior as well.
We're on with Dr. Alan Sackey's president of the Drake Group. You can learn a lot more about the Drake Group at www.thedrakegroup.org. Dr. Sack, talk a little bit about what's really interesting. I really want to get into this with you right now, is that you had some interesting proposals on the table about for change. Can you walk us through some of the proposed changes that the Drake Group would like to pursue?
Yeah, we start off with that notion about defending academic integrity and what are some of the things we can do to do that. Some very precise things. By the way, this is a real surprise to me and also a real, in my life, a high point really in my life involved with sports, is that several months ago, and this is after I had talked with you last, the National Collegiate Athletic Association passed a piece of legislation which the press has pretty much ignored, but I think it's one of the most important reforms in recent NCAA history, I really do, and that is that the NCAA has passed multi-year scholarships. In other words, something that I've argued for 25 years finally has come to fruition, that a young man or a young woman who accepts a scholarship, a school has the option of making that a four-year scholarship guaranteed, that you will not lose it if you end up being a recruiting mistake or dead wood, so to speak, or if you're injured. I thought that rule should have never come into existence back in 1973. It was one of the worst decisions I think the NCAA ever made, and it's one of the best things I've seen of late to show at least a certain kind of positive movement by the National Collegiate Athletic Association. Of course, they barely got it through, which shows you, I think, and proves to you how many of the schools out there really did depend on one-year renewable scholarships to get rid of the dead wood. They swore up and down for years. I don't think I've ever run into a coach who ever admitted or an athletic director that ever said at their school that they would ever run a kid off. They always said, no, that happens someplace else maybe, but it doesn't happen much. It's really a rarity. That's really bull, honestly. Because they barely got the legislation through. About half of the schools actually voted against multi-year scholarships. That means that they were benefiting from the one-year renewable scholarships because they wanted to be able to run off the athletes who weren't allowing them to win, to make the big money, and they were treating the athletes like commodities. So the NCAA only went halfway on this. They said it's an option. You don't have to give multi-year or four-year scholarships. It's up to the school. And I had a list earlier up on the web of all the schools that voted against it. But the Big Ten all voted for multi-year scholarships. And then there are some schools in the Southeast Conference and others that you'd be very surprised. They're very wealthy schools and they do very well. And they voted against the multi-year scholarships. But the Drake Group supports that 100%, and we are euphoric that the NCAA at least made this move in that direction. We think that... I think there's a role for affirmative action in our society. I think in education in particular, if there's a young man or a woman who has worked very hard and they don't quite come up to the total standard, and you can see that the kind of backgrounds that they've fought their way through, give them a break, give them a try, okay? And that stands for athletes as well in terms of admissions. But for God's sake, if you bring in someone who's really not up to the same level as everyone else at the start level as a freshman, they had no place on an athletic field. They should not be a young man or a young woman should not be playing their first game on national television before they go into the classroom for the first time in their freshman year. They should be sitting out. So the second proposal that we make in the Drake group is to make athletes who are special admits, who are really questionable about whether they should have been admitted at all, given the regular admission standards, make them ineligible to participate in college sports during their freshman year. I can't tell you how strongly I feel about that one. They should get in, but they should be sitting out that first year, and they should be adjusting to academic life, and they should be, you know, priorities should be being set in terms of getting a degree at that school, and so forth. And then I could go quickly through the others so I don't take up too much of your time, but required students to maintain a grade point average of 2.0. A little tough love here as well. I mean, you give athletes a four-year scholarship, I think that's priceless. To think that you're going to play ball and they're not going to be able to take that scholarship away from you if you're injured or if you don't really live up to the coach's expectation, and you're going to be able to earn a degree that could cost as much as $120,000, $140,000 over 4 years. That is a wonderful, wonderful gift, and I'm glad the NCAA has made it possible in some schools to do that. But on the other hand, the athletes have a responsibility to really go into the classroom and to apply themselves to taking advantage of that wonderful gift. 2.0, if you can't keep a 2.0 immediately, you become ineligible. If you can't get that 2.0 back up to 2.0 within the next semester, you lose your scholarship and you're out of there. That's the reality, and that's not unreasonable. You need a 2.0 to graduate, and that's what we want. We want the athletes to graduate, and preferably from the school that they entered. With regard to academic counseling, one of the major goals of the NCAA, according to its own manual, is to maintain athletes as an integral part of the student body. I do not understand, nor do the other people in my organization, how taking athletes and separating them out into their own specialized counseling areas and having their own specialized support services, oftentimes at the cost of millions of dollars to build these things, and having these athletes totally segregated from the rest of the student body in that regard. We think that the academic counseling should go on. It should be supported. It's very important. It's good for athletes, but it's good for non-athletes as well, and they should be together. They should be in the same counseling centers. They should be being tutored by the same tutors. It should all be part of one thing. All too often what happens is we end up with the athletes going off, and tutoring turns into having the tutors writing papers. They're isolated from the rest of the student body. They're playing football. They come out of football practice. They eat together. Then they go off and they study together, if in fact that's what you want to call it. And they're not becoming part of the mainstream, and we think all athletes should be part of the regular student body. We think there should be policies established to ensure that this is a problem even at the smaller schools, that the athletic contests are scheduled so that they don't conflict with classes. And very much, I'm disturbed. I don't see how we can ever move away from it, but the Wednesday night football game, you know, the Thursday night football game, the tremendous pressure that's been put on the universities and the university put on themselves by developing a highly commercial model. So now that the schedules are driven not by the needs of the athletes, but by the needs of the networks. I don't blame the networks, by the way. I blame the colleges and universities for giving in to the networks on this. But there has to be greater concern about how that scheduling is taking place, how this conference realignment affects that scheduling, should you be traveling across the country back and forth to be in one conference. These things we want to confront in some way. And then finally, one of the more difficult ones, I'll just read it to you, to ensure that universities provide accountability of their trustees, administrators, and faculty by public disclosure of academic evidence of the quality of education being given athletes. It's a little wordy. Let me break that down. What we're saying is, are these athletes really being educated? And what is the evidence that, in fact, they are being educated? The Buckley Amendment does not allow us to look at athletes right now. It does allow that, but the NCAA and others misinterpret it. We should be able to know the kinds of classes that athletes are taking, as well as non-athletes. We should know if they're being clustered and kind of pushed into certain kinds of majors rather than others by their coaches, and if there's a disproportionate number in that class. We should even know the kinds of SAT scores that athletes have in it as a category. We don't want to pick on any one athlete. I think that's a violation of privacy. But U.S. News and World Report reports SAT scores for thousands, millions of young Americans in their yearly magazine. We should know more about the kinds of backgrounds that the athletes are coming from, the kind of problems they may confront, and then be able to adjust for that. So we need transparency. And in that regard, we're really upset with faculty. This is like a family feud, kind of. I'm a faculty member. Our family's not doing the job that we're supposed to do professionally. When we allow students to just drift on through our classes, and because it happens to be a star on the team, let them miss a lot of classes and give them an A anyway, we are not doing a service to those athletes. We are, in fact, exploiting them and contributing and reinforcing the stereotypes in the society against athletes in general, African Americans sometimes in particular. So these are the kinds of things that we believe we can move toward through lobbying efforts, by efforts in maybe in state legislatures, by maybe even now working with the NCAA, since they've shown an array of hope. Will they go a little further in helping us with some of these things?
You're on with the Real Sports Guys. We're on with Dr. Alan Sack. He's the president of the Drake Group. He just walked through some of the proposed changes that they would like to lobby for, and some of them have already made their way through NCAA. But the two that I think are most promising on this list, I agree. The scheduling one, I saw the scheduling one. I felt like that one, if I looked at it, I would put that one lower on the list. But I understand
which one is that
the
again?
Value,
sorry.
The one about a run around scheduling. I think if you do some of the other things, we can come back to that one. The one that I think is really interesting is about the ineligibility of special admits.
Yes.
That one I think is a real possible one, because I do think that we need to think about the foundation of the students who are most vulnerable that we bring through our review process. Because not all athletes come to special admit, not even if we have athletes who are regularly admitted. You know, these students who, you know, athletes done well in high school, and some of them are stars. But we do have students who come through as special admits that I think this idea of making sure they're grounded educationally and that they have the security of the multi-year renewable scholarship. Which I think is very important. And I think the other one, which I think is critical, and this is an interesting one, is athletes getting services in the place where all the other students get it. Even when you interview athletes after they've left institutions, they talk about the idea that they weren't really connected to the rest of the campus, to a person. I don't care if they played NFL or whatever. One of the things they reflect back on is that they didn't really feel like they were connected to their community. And I think this is something that I feel like this is something that the faculty control.
They do. In many ways, they do. Yes.
The faculty kind of gave up on.
No, the faculty should be taking a lot of responsibility for this. And in the faculty senates have the right to determine how counseling is going to go on. This is part of the academic realm of the university.
Yeah.
And most of the stuff I've read and research that I've done and on graduation rates sees a very strong relationship between the federal graduation rate, which means the federal graduation measures the percentage of of students who graduate, the percentage of athletes who enter a university who actually graduate from that university. That's the federal graduation rate, and that's a measure of retention. And much of the research that I reviewed and the stuff I've done myself shows that the students who are most integrated into the university community are the ones who are most likely to graduate from that school. And I really think there's something important about it's okay to transfer, but not all the time. I think if you choose your school not merely because of its athletics, but because it has something else there that you really liked in their academic program or something else, then you're more likely to want to stay there. And if you're given the opportunity to take advantage of that stuff that you liked in the classroom or in the kind of curriculum that you were looking for, rather than being pushed around into the segregated life we're talking about, the more likely you are to graduate. So I think that the whole idea of being an integral part of the student body is critical, and I think that is a major issue with the segregation of these athletes. Generally, they're segregated, not just on racial grounds, but then on racial grounds, it becomes even more so because we're having kids coming from inner-city backgrounds, coming from different kinds of communities, ending up in all-white universities, and naturally, I think, in many ways, trying to hold together and feel comfortable there, sticking around with the same kinds of kids. I'd love to see it split up with everyone just... When I say all these things, it's because this is what I lived when I played football at Notre Dame back in the 1960s. I met people in dormitories from all over the world and all over the United States from all kinds of social class backgrounds. And it's one of the greatest things that happened to me. And I was an athlete. I was not in a jock dorm, and I was in there with athletes and non-athletes. And to this day, I have friends who are lawyers in Chicago, people on Wall Street, people who are from all walks of life and backgrounds, and that's a wonderful thing, and that's part of the educational process. Many athletes, I think, are being robbed of that, and got to stop that one, I think.
We're on with Dr. Alan Sack, and before I bring Phil in, the message track you're hitting, and we is a good friend of yours, Ramogi Human. We had Ramogi on, and part of the tension that I had with some of the discussion we had there, that much of it was about athletes getting their fair share. And what I said prior to bringing you on the show explains why just getting your fair share doesn't guarantee you a better life experience. So the discussion is usually around the money, but the discussion we're having right now is around feeding you for a lifetime.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the critical difference I see with the break group, is about how do we get these student athletes engaged? How do they get what they should have come from? Is a college experience that is transformative? Is that, am I reading that difference? Not to say that there's friction between the two, but I'm sensing two different ways of approaching this issue.
That's very that's very observant on your part. Not too many people would pick on. That's kind of a subtle thing that Romy and I consider Ramogi and myself to be very good friends, and we agree just about everything. But we're coming from this at a slightly different perspective. I agree with everything he does, just about everything he does. But the Drake Group's mission is somewhat different than his. Our mission is primarily, we would like to see, ultimately, the ideal university would be one without professional college sports on it. In other words, the athletes would not be employees, okay? And we would like to move to a situation where that's the case. There are no longer any employees, meaning getting rid of one-year renewable scholarships and moving as much as possible toward, it won't be amateurism, but it'll maybe come closer to that. Ramogi is seeing it like it is, especially in those schools that offer one-year renewable scholarships. And he's saying, come on, you turn these kids into employees. They are being paid, and if they don't perform, they're being kicked off. Therefore, how can I leave this out? They're generating millions and millions, and billions is not really an exaggeration of money in terms of television contracts. How can we not allow them a cut of that in some way? And Ramogi's not as crazy as I was 30 years ago, not crazy, but radical. And I was talking about forming unions and getting salaries for the athletes. Part of me still believes that. Ramogi doesn't go that far. He just says, wait a minute, how about a stipend, right? How come these athletes can't have the same thing I'm talking about in terms of educational opportunities? But in addition to that, he supports the idea of having some more financial support for kids who just don't have other kids can have a car drive around campus if they come from a rich and wealthy family. They can drive in limousines. They can go off to Europe in the summer. I mean, And a college athlete has to live with room, board, tuition, and fees, which doesn't even cover the total cost of education.
Yeah.
I support Ramogi on that, but the Drake Group is not focusing its attention on that. If people like yourself or others ask me about that, say, go to Ramogi and the National College Players Association, because they are the ones that know how to do that. Right? And, but we'll work together wherever we can, but we're trying to keep our mission just a little different. We have the same kind of feeling. I'm sorry, go ahead.
You listen to the Real Sports Guys and RealSportsGuys.com. We have the pleasure of chatting with Alan Sack, Dr. Alan Sack from University of New Haven, where he's an interim dean as well as a faculty member there. Dr. Sack, there's been a lot of stuff in the news with conference realignment. Just recently, Boise State, which is in Idaho, they just agreed to join the Big East. And, you know, you talked about scheduling conflicts. Can you talk about the Drake Group's position on conference realignment and how that's adding to these student-athletes having to have these radical travel schedules?
Right. To a lead-in to that, the whole issue of conference realignment to penetrate new markets, that whole notion goes so against the NCAA's basic mission statement. The NCAA says the purpose of the NCAA is maintain athletes an integral part of the student body, A, traveling around the country doesn't help you do that much, and B, to maintain a clear line of demarcation between professional and college sports. You tell me how the conference realignment that's taking place now, primarily to enter new market areas, whether it's in Dallas or whether it's the Northeast Coast or what have you, you tell me what that has to do with education. Has nothing to do with education, has nothing to do with maintaining a clear line of demarcation between professional and college sports. In fact, it erases the line between professional and college sports because we're doing the same thing that the pros are doing. That, in fact, everything that's done strategically is to make more money. And colleges and universities are supposed to be about not making more money, but helping to educate the athletes themselves. And then to address your question, I've seen, you know, contradictory studies about this. Does that travel really hurt? I'd have to read more about it, and maybe, to be fair, I have to do more research. But my gut feeling is, from having played myself, man, when you travel from Notre Dame out to California, and then you're coming back and you're trying to study just once or twice a year, you're doing this, you know, not that many trips. And then you say that you're going to move, you're going to be traveling on Wednesday nights, and you're going to be traveling on distances constantly just so that you can make more money in that way. That is not healthy for the athletes. I can't believe that the NCAA is allowed to get away with that, that in fact it is such a movement toward professionalization, developing leagues, actually, in different – the conferences are like you're talking about franchises and located in different parts of the country. It's becoming indistinguishable from professional sports. Why that doesn't go before Congress through the House Ways and Means Committee, where they challenge their not-for-profit status and their tax, you know, the fact that they are tax-exempt. I don't know how they can get away with it. It's not good for – it's not done for the athletes to begin with, and then clearly it is not in the interest of education to have breaking up the conferences with that kind of travel.
You listen to the Real Sports Guys on realsportsguys.com. We're talking to Dr. Alan Sack, the author of Counterfeit Amateurs, which is Real Sports Guys Certified. We suggest you all to – it's a great read. Dr. Sack, last time you were on, you mentioned that the term student-athlete was – it's a newer one, because there was no doubt when you were playing that you guys were students first. Talk a little bit about this stuff that's been going on with kids wanting to transfer, and, you know, most recently in Wisconsin, the coach allowed a basketball player to transfer but gave him different stipulations. What are your thoughts on the coaches having this much control over a young man's athletic and academic career?
Well, to begin with, I truly would advise young men and women who are in college – to choose a college on the basis of its educational contributions rather than merely on the basis of sports. So I kind of frown on the notion of an athlete getting up and transferring because they want another kind of offense or defense or athletic kind of thing. On the other hand, they have every right to go. I mean, I would counsel kids and say, look, think twice. Why are you making this decision? You came to the school. The main goal is to get a degree from here. You want to be in biophysics, or you want to be in chemistry, or you want to be in history, or what have you. And you've got to, if you have a full scholarship, especially if it's a four-year scholarship, please, before you start jumping from place to place because of sports, think about what you're giving up. But if any student, whether it's an athlete or a non-athlete, wants to leave and go from one school to another for whatever reason that is, they should be perfectly allowed to do that. It is merely, again, it's merely the coaches trying to defend their competitive advantage and not allowing an athlete to move to another school, not for the athlete's betterment. It's not because they're trying to save the athlete in some way or help their education. It's because they don't want this really fine ball player playing against them and making it more difficult for them to compete. So my answer is a quick and easy one to that one, that the coaches should not be able to, and the NCAA rule should be really changed dramatically to allow students, they are students, and these athletes are students, to make the same kind of choice that any other student makes. If they want to leave, they can leave. Although, like I said, I would sit down and counsel a young man or woman and say, let's see why you're doing this, if it's the right motive, and what is the long-term impact going to be of your leaving, particularly if it's because of sports, and what are your possibilities of being in the NFL, and what do you really want in life here? And so I talked to the kid for a long time, and if they still wanted to do that, hey, that's their right. It should be.
So, Dr. Sack, are you in some ways, especially when we're talking about special omits and some of the things, are you proposing a return to kind of what we did with what, Prop 48 or 42? Are you proposing that sort of approach to athletics in terms of how we're handling some of the special omits?
That's a very, very good question. And earlier on when we were kind of touching on this point, I wanted to say that the idea of freshman ineligibility has been around for a long, long time. Even after they allowed freshmen to start playing in the 1970s, it was still there in the former Prop 48. It amounts to the same thing as freshman ineligibility. But it limits the ineligibility to a certain group. You know, when I played, nobody could play as a freshman, whether you were a Phi Beta Kappa 4.0 straight A student, or whether you're a 1.8 student coming into the university, you were not going to play until you're a sophomore. I look at that and I say, okay, I could see the reasoning, and probably it was a good thing. But there were a lot of kids who could make it as freshmen. There were, and especially now you have young women, and there are young men and young women who are pretty mature, and they can make it through that first year and handle the stress of the football or basketball, whatever game they happen to be playing. They should be able to play. But if you're a special admit, that suggests to me that you're going to have some struggles. You're coming in there with a background of academic disadvantages of various types, and you should have to sit out that first year. Now, the consequences of that are they have some competitive consequences. A special admit at Southern Cal is going to be of a much higher caliber in terms of their academic ability than the special admit at the lower end of maybe the Boise States, where the academic standards aren't quite as high. So one could argue that could work against the most competitive institutions, right? Because they're not going to be able to get in those. Prop 48 would let you bring a kid into Notre Dame or into Duke or whatever with an 800 combined SAT score, you know? But that goes beyond special admissions at Stanford and at those other schools. Mm-hmm. There, the special admit's going to be a kid with maybe 1,000, maybe 1,010 or something in the SAT combined. Mm-hmm. So, but what I'm actually saying is rather radical. I'm suggesting, but I think very reasonable, that that whatever school it is, you look at the general profile of your student body. You do allow some kids to get in who are right on the borderline, and some maybe a little over. We call them special admits. If you fall in that category, whether it's at Duke University or whether it's at whether it's at Boise State or San Jose or wherever, you're simply going to sit it out for the first year. And I think that is perfectly I support that 100%.
As we close, can you talk a little bit about some of the action steps, what you hope to get accomplished, you know, within the next 6 months to a year? You have a pretty aggressive agenda, but how are you going to attack it?
First of all, I get out of the job I'm in right now, which is the interim dean, get my life back in shape. And then we're going to start in with I have it right here in front of me. My 3-year plan, or our 3-year plan. We're working on our not-for-profit status right now, and the Drake Group will finally be a not-for-profit LLC, limited liability corporation. And we needed that. We haven't had it for 13 years, so we finally get started, and we're kind of a real group. We start reaching out to other organizations to work with them on some of the reform measures we're talking about, including Ramogi's group, the National College Players Association. I want to work immediately on the extension of what Ramogi and I have done in Connecticut. We have an Athlete's Right to Know Act that we had passed a year and a half ago, and Ramogi came out here from California, because he had just passed a similar act in California. So Schwarzenegger, right, that was the governor, signed that into law back about 2 years ago. That is really propitious for us. If you combine that with what the Athlete's Right to Know Act in Connecticut means, is that the universities have to publish on a link right on their webpage, on the front of their athletic department webpage, on a whatever they call it, a super link or whatever it's called, they have to publish what their policies are on financial aid, on injury compensation, and so forth. But financial aid here, right now, I want to talk about the financial aid thing. The NCAA's recent passage of the multi-year scholarship thing will now have to be reported on every one of those websites in Connecticut on a Division I school. So that parents will be able to get on there and know whether UConn actually gives multi-year scholarships or does not. Out in California, they're going to have to report that same kind of information. So the families are going to have total transparency in knowing that. And let me tell you, I myself personally would never send my daughter or my son to a school that gave a one-year renewable scholarship. So we're not only in favor of that rule, but we're going to disclose what schools do it and what schools don't. If they're lying about it, they're breaking the law, because we got the law passed in Connecticut and California. So the next thing we're doing, we're going to Texas and we're going to Ohio, and we're going to try to get that passed throughout the entire country. So that's one of the first things we're going to start on. But take it easy. We'll take it one at a time. We're going to take one step out to Texas, where we have a close friend who knows the governor, can help us start on that. We are going to be building our website. We're going to be working on whistleblowing legislation for faculty who find themselves being, literally, if they're not tenured, kicked out of the university. Like up at a university, it was the State University of New York at Binghamton, someone that we know in our group had blown the whistle on corruption there, and they end up just being kind of just shoved aside. They lose their job. Coach goes on someplace else, makes a couple million dollars, and we forget about it. So we should be able to protect faculty who step up and say, "Wait a minute, this is academic malfeasance, and I'm going to. Should not have to be a martyr for doing that. You're just doing your job." Membership drive. We hope to build 400 members. Go up to 10,000 in a couple of years. We have a lot of things, and it would take too much of your time for me to go through it all. But there's a lot to do, and all of it comes right back to those major proposals that I explained earlier on in our discussion, because we think they're right on target. And I agree with you, and I appreciate your supporting some of those, the idea of the multi-year scholarships, the idea of freshman eligibility, the idea of controlling the times of games and the scheduling of the games and the practices, and really, most, from my point of view, most importantly, making sure the athletes are a part of the student body. making sure that they are an integral part of the student body and not just isolated at the end of campus and kind of alienated and leaving, going off to the pros, and then ending up, as you started your discussion tonight, ending up being bankrupt after a couple of years getting out of college because they never really learned more about themselves as human beings. They never really became well-educated citizens in some of the finest universities in the United States. That is really an embarrassment.
Well, Dr. Sack, we certainly enjoyed having you on with us tonight, and we'd love to bring you back with Ramogi because I think we could have an interesting conversation and a panel-like discussion.
Oh, we could.
We're going to try to get that. We're going to get that set up. You know, you're a friend of the program, and we certainly enjoy having you on. And I want to wish you well in everything you do, and take care.
Now, I can't tell you how much I appreciate the opportunity to make these points and having you guide me through this whole thing so that this doesn't end up being a shouting match. So at least I'm able to make the point and people can kind of go over in their own minds and decide whether it makes sense. So thank you very much for the kind of show that you have. It's greatly appreciated.
All right. Take care.
Thank you.
Well, that was Dr. Alan Sack, who is the author of Counterfeit Amateurs, which you can find on our website at realsportsguys.com. It's a must-read. If you really want to understand how this all came about, his book will take you right through it. It provides also an aspect of his own personal journey from being an athlete, being a college professor, to being a college administrator, working with organizations like the Drake Group. But it's definitely a must-read. Again, you can get that at realsportsguys.com. A lot there. I'm going to bring in our man who was taking care of business tonight, the Game Changer, to kind of reflect and recap. How you doing, Game Changer?
I'm good, man. How's it going?
Man, that was fire, man. It was I started out the conversation, man, talking about Seau, but transitioning to a lot of the issues that came out of it, that kind of emerged about how athletes transition to life, the high percentage of NFL players who 78% find themselves in bankruptcy 2 years after finishing, 90% of NFL players who make $15 million or more ending up in bankruptcy. There's an incredible list of athletes who, notable athletes, who have ended up in bankruptcy. Johnny Unitas made $4 million, declared bankruptcy in 1991. Deuce McAllister made $70 million, declared bankruptcy in 2010. Demonte Dawson, who I love, you know, Steelers, $55 million. Michael Vick, we remember that, $130 million. Lawrence Taylor made $50 million, declared bankruptcy. Mark Brunell made $13 million. Travis Henry made $20 million. Charlie Batch made $13 million. You know, and so part of what we talked about with Dr. Sack, and you probably heard it towards the end, is this whole notion of feeding athletes for a lifetime. That we have to come up with strategies that feed folks for a lifetime. And because our current strategy, this is a trend across particularly our major revenue generating sports, as it translates to their professional careers, being able to make those decisions, being able to think. Chris Carter's talked a little bit about this, you know, understanding that sports has to be part of a larger plan, and how we get that. So this has been a great conversation, and some of the changes they were talking about, I don't know if you had a chance to hear some of the goals around how you handle special admits in terms of having them sit down, having advising. Both of you and I have been part of the academic support structure in our lives, that academic advising around athletes should be happening in space where all the other academic advising is happening for all other students, and support should be in those spaces. So those are the things that are up. And I don't know how much you heard, but I'd love to get your perspective. I know you have perspective.
Well, I heard the tail end of the interview, and, you know, I appreciate you rattling off that list of names, because I think sometimes when people have that conversation around how we develop athletes into more than just, you know, big, fast, touchdown scoring, basketball dunking human beings. They oftentimes say, well, athletes are irresponsible, and I think the default image that comes into their mind is young and African-American. And you talked about, you know, Johnny Unitas and Mark Brunell and guys like that who've also gone bankrupt. So it's not just it's not confined to a specific age demographic or a specific race of or a specific socioeconomic background that student athletes come from as they turn into professionals. But I thought that Dr. Sack laid out some excellent points in talking about the special admit and how it can be a way of, again, ensuring that student athletes that come into a university are allowed to be just that, you know, student athletes, and we should capitalize that first letter of student. It's a capital S, not a small S. Oftentimes you see it written with a small S, student athlete. It should be a capital S because that's what they are first. And allowing them that leeway to just focus on their academics, get settled into an academic environment, develop some academic skills, build their academic base just as we would if with their athletic base. Just as mm-hmm. coaches give kids a redshirt year athletically to get stronger, to get faster, get quicker, get more explosive, that same approach can be taken and should be taken sometimes with certain student athletes who aren't where they need to be academically but are where they need to be as far as their athletic talents go. To provide that balance, and if you know, if kids aren't taught that balance, they won't learn that balance. And again, the end result is you see guys on the other side going bankrupt because they haven't found out, they haven't figured out how to manage themselves. The other side of the sword is how much do we continue to micromanage the lives of these student athletes? Because part of the reason that a lot of them do wind up going broke is because of the micromanaging and people making decisions for them and not being able to be independent. A lot of these athletes, once they get on the other side of their pro career and they don't have that regimented schedule laid out for them by a coach or GM or, you know, the team equipment manager or whoever, when those schedules of where to be, when to be there, what you need to bring, what you need to have isn't laid out for them, they really don't have the life skills necessary to be successful. And so, again, what that looks like, what that special admit system looks like, is it building that independence, that autonomy, that ability to make life decisions away from your AAU coach, away from, you know, your high school coach, independently of all those things that most college students get to do. As a college student, you and I, when we went away to school, we were allowed to kind of grow and develop. You know, we were far enough away from our families where if there was an emergency, I could call mom, I could call dad, they can get there, they can help me, get me out of a jam, help me figure out how to solve the situation. But I was far enough away where I could also say, you know what, I'm going to handle this on my own. I'm going to try and figure it out. I'm going to try and navigate it. Or I'm going to reach out. I'm going to take it upon myself and reach out and see what resources are out there for me outside of my family. Maybe I want to talk to a Devon Wilson. Maybe I want to talk to a Cecil Youngblood. Or maybe I want to reach out to a peer. But you have the space to do that. So that's another piece of it when we're talking about this process of developing kind of well-rounded student-athletes. How are we giving them an opportunity to also experience that part of the college experience where you grow and you learn how to pay a bill, you learn how to balance a checkbook, and you don't have to hire somebody to do it for you? You know, and I think that's where a lot of these guys wind up broke, is because they're outsourcing, you know, jobs and tasks that they could do themselves. And they're paying a buddy, which is great. You know, you're trying to help a friend out. But, again, this is where it ends up. Or they're going into bad business ventures. So there's a lot of layers to it. But I like what he said about giving them that time to grow as a student just as much as we want to offer that athletically.
And I think part of the key, because people who are in athletic in the athletic operation sometimes see kind of the intellectual curiosity and the freedom as a threat to the athletic operation. And rather than seeing it as an empowering stuff that actually might make them better athletes. And so, you know, to have somebody who can be analytical, who can think, to pick information up real quickly, who can kind of work around things, makes them will make, in my argument, make them much better athletes over time. And so it's part of how you get that people to understand that that's all the stuff that you talked about that I think you just nailed, that I know you nailed, that capacity building that over the long haul actually makes them better athletes and more or less makes them better pros. Because these are folks who part of it is even getting the athletes to understand that's part of your broader brand development that goes beyond your sport, that makes you even better when you leave your sport, that gets you into other areas of development that allows for you to do what the Todd Duggett's doing, that you continue to do it. Even when the crowd is silent, you are still creating opportunities for others, therefore creating opportunities for yourself. But that capacity building that you're talking about is really important, and it's in really articulating to the athletic administration and the coaching staff that's a value added going back to producing better people on the field. And so I think that is that right there, that point is important. The key with this, and that I hit Dr. Sackwood, is the faculty have a lot of control over this that they've just kind of let go. You and I have spent time on college campuses, and we know the governance system and that faculty are involved in all these stages, particularly at larger universities. And sometimes faculty have just kind of washed their hands of it. And what's their role in regaining charge of this, and as well as provosts and chancellors? So there's a whole operation there that can impact this that hasn't really engaged it at a high level that needs to start doing it. And I don't know how they're going to get that level of engagement that they need to have happen with faculty.
I agree wholeheartedly. And you hit a lot of things on the head with your statements right there, talking about coaches not wanting kids to seeing that academic engagement as a threat. And I think sometimes college coaches substitute confinement. They mistake confinement for commitment. Where if I confine your world to these walls, you're committed. You know, and that's not commitment.
Keep going.
You know, that's not commitment. When you talk about if I confine your world to these to you know the workout facility, the practice field, and our study center, if I confine your world, then I have you committed. And that's not what commitment should look like for a student athlete. And I think they academics use that as a threat because they feel like if I allow this young man to explore the world, to expand his horizons, this young man or woman, to explore the world and expand their horizons, they may become committed to something outside of my sport. And I've invested too much into this kid, too many resources into recruiting this student-athlete, too many resources into supporting this student-athlete, keeping them eligible for them to then find a new commitment and a new passion and a new avenue. So I need to confine and control the parameters of which they're going to engage in this experience so that I can keep them committed to what I'm selling, what I'm pursuing. Because if they find something else, now they got options. And a person with options is not going to put up with, you know, some of the things that go on in a high-level D1 program mm-hmm. as far as how coaches interact with athletes. You know, if somebody has some options, they're going to pursue other things, and they're going to begin to pursue other things. But if you can control what they're exposed to and what opportunities they have ahead of them, then you kind of control that. And I think that's what coaches unfortunately mistake. They take the confinement and view it as commitment. And it's fool's gold on their part, and it's also detrimental to the student-athlete because eventually if a person is not going to be committed, they're not going to be committed. If they're not committed, there's nothing you can do to make them committed. That's an internal battle that has to be fought internally by that particular student athlete or person, and outside forces. You try it. You try to make somebody commit to something they don't want to commit to. Go ahead. So,
before we get into our folk editorial, I just want to say, Gabe Chaser, it's good to have you come up. You kind of came off the bench like Willis Reed. You just came in. And Phil, I want to give you the last word. I know you had to close out with Dr. Sack, but I'd like to give you last word on this segment before we go to Funky Editorial.
Hey, you guys covered it all. I really enjoyed hearing you, the wrap-up conversation. And obviously having Dr. Sack on, you know, I mean, he kind of kicked it off for us this year and set the tone for the quality of guests that we've had on for the last 4 or 5 months. You know, it kind of reminds me, you know, why the show was started and why we enjoy doing what we do in terms of with the real sports guys. Because Dr. Sack and the Drake Group, they really talk to some serious knee-deep issues where you're bringing in people that have the ability to change a culture in terms of faculty and change a lot of the things that we as spectators, former student athletes, and concerned observers see what's wrong with the system. But there's a group of concerned faculty and staff that have the ability, the means, and the desire to kind of change and improve the experience for student athletes. So I really encourage listeners that are just tuning in to go back to realsportsguys.com tomorrow and listen to this interview in its entirety.
Thank you. And we're going to go into that funky editorial.
Fellas, only one thing we need to say. Yes, shall we say it, y'all? Yes, Melvin, right. Jimmy, yes, Coleman, Ryan, say it. Everybody want to get funky one more time.
All right. Our funky editorial tonight, as I told you in the rundown, and I'm glad we had to wait to get the Game Changer here. I don't hope we don't get Mrs. Game Changer on the phone because I've been going back with her for her on
you
Facebook.
You don't want that.
And I described to the listeners she kind of like MC Light mixed with Jay-Z. She's venomous.
That's right.
She spits it. And we go hit this Kodo fight. But, fellas, I'll go to you first, Game Changer. Your impressions of the fight. Talk a little bit about it. What's your initial impressions of the fight?
Well, you know, I appreciate the shout out to the Mrs. Game Changer, because we were a bit torn on whether or not to purchase the fight. You know, Mrs. Game Changer, after the last experience with Floyd fight, and the way it ended and the way it turned out, she wasn't too keen on putting money in that brother's pocket. She had some moral issues about giving that cat some money. So we bit the bullet and we bought the fight, and it was well worth it. It was well worth the money we spent to watch it. My initial impressions was it was an excellent fight. I felt like Cotto had opportunities to take control of the fight. Floyd came out the gates early and really established the tempo at which he wanted to fight. It took Cotto a minute to kind of adjust and feel out how what was going to work against Floyd and how he could attack Floyd. And I think once Cotto figured it out, he had a couple of – I would say he had about three rounds, three consecutive rounds. I think it was the sixth, seventh, and eighth round where I felt like he really began to take control of the fight. And where I felt like Cotto lost it was in the ninth round. He pulled back. To me, I felt like he pulled back off of his strategy. He was really pressing Floyd, getting Floyd up against the ropes and trying to attack. Floyd is excellent at avoiding punches, especially avoiding right-handed shots with where he rolls his shoulder. And so with that, you know, getting him in the corner, you could throw a flurry of shots and also anticipate his answers because he was in such a confined space. And when Cotto had him there, he was putting in some work. And I think he had to continue to press him, but I think he expended a lot of energy in those three rounds just trying to get – I felt like he was just trying to get back into the fight. And then in the ninth round, I felt like Cotto eased off the gas a little bit and let Floyd kind of get back into his rhythm. It's kind of like when you got a good score or someone out of their rhythm and then you let them get to the free throw line, and then they get a couple easy looks, and now they, you know, they get four or five straight free throw attempts, and now they're back in their rhythm, and now they're going again. Or you let them get an easy bucket on a fast break or something like that. And I feel like that's what Cotto did with Mayweather. And after that, Mayweather just had control of it. And then it got to a point where, you know, 11th, 10th round, I feel like, you know, Cotto, you got to knock him out. And I don't know if Cotto felt, and maybe that's why he bucked out of the ring the way he did, because I don't know if he felt that the fight was going the way I think everybody else saw it. I think most people who were watching the fight felt like, okay, if this goes to the cards, Mayweather's going to win this fight. Cotto has to knock him out, but I don't think Cotto felt that way. I think Cotto felt like he could continue to fight his fight and let it go to a decision. I didn't feel like that was it. I wasn't sure if Cotto was aware of the sense. He didn't box in the last two rounds with the sense of urgency that I got to knock this cat out or someone who's fight. I don't know if he was aware of that, because I felt like he was down several rounds. I think you scored him down a couple rounds. So that's how I felt about
the
fight. I felt like Cotto had an opportunity. Go ahead.
No, I think you hit it right on the head, and I was right with you. I scored two a draw, three Cotto, and I gave the next two rounds, four and five, to Mayweather, and then six through eight I gave to Cotto. I felt like in the middle rounds he stepped it up. But I think you hit it right on the head. From the ninth round on, I gave all those to Mayweather. And I just felt like Cotto stopped using the jab. He stopped trying to control things, and he fell into that trap that Mayweather normally puts you into. And I just felt like he should have picked up the pace. I think you hit it right on the head. Phil, what were your initial impressions?
Well, my initial impression, first of all, was Bernard Hopkins and those ugly glasses he had.
Oh, PAZ, you ain't never lied.
Ringside, you know, I was texting y'all back and forth, and of course, Mrs. Game Changer had something to say about those glasses.
But, oh my goodness, she was classic.
I mean, I was just thinking, I'm like, man, what's up with these glasses, B Hop? I mean, and you right there. I mean, he's at center ring, third row. You can see him sitting right next to De La Hoya. So, but outside of that, I enjoyed the fight. We saw Floyd extend it. Probably the most we've seen him extended in the last 4 to 5 years, I'd say. Perhaps even longer. You know, you think about his most recent fights with Haddon, Marquez, and then recently Ortiz. There were no questions about who won that fight. Floyd, it's a toss-up if he even lost a round in his last three fights. So, you know, Floyd had his takeoff. And, of course, Larry Merchant. You know, I was actually looking for more fireworks between him and Merchant, but Floyd took the high road, and Larry Merchant was goading him. He was goading him, but Floyd didn't take the bait this time. But, you know, Floyd told Larry, listen, I'm trying to get a fan something for them to see. Come on now, Floyd, don't front. Cotto was a beast. Because let's think about it, and yes, I mean, this is the same Phil T who went out on a limb, and that limb snapped. It snapped on me.
It
I got
snapped.
A broken arm.
It snapped. I was going to
okay.
Yep.
But I went out on a limb and said that I like Cotto in that fight. And I'll tell you why. Cotto's a Hall of Fame fighter in my mind. Let's take a look at his three losses. He lost to Margarito, and we already know a lot of questions there. Most people view that as an illegitimate win. He's lost to Mayweather, and he's lost to Pacquiao. Okay?
Pacquiao did a catch.
So,
you Pacquiao fans. I just want to say that. Sorry about that, Phil. I'll go back to you. I had to make sure I said that. Catch weight to Pacquiao. Phil, I'll
okay.
go back to you.
So, you know, I mean, Pacquiao, I'm sorry, Cotto kind of stole my heart. I mean, he just stole it when he beat up Margarito in October. I just gained so much respect for that cat, and I like the way that he goes about his business. In boxing, we see so much show, and this guy is just about fam and taking care of his. And so, from a technical standpoint, you know, I like Cotto's strategy early on in the fight, the first couple of rounds, where he was content in being aggressive and kind of keeping, you know, kind of cutting off the ring for Floyd. And in some ways, I wish he would have stuck with that, because Floyd looked shook a few times. And as you mentioned, Devon, Cotto won two straight rounds, 6-7, and most people would even argue that 8 was a toss-up. So, and when he won those rounds, that was his strategy. So, you know, I mean, he's had some instability as far as his corner, but honestly, I like the direction that he's headed with this guy, with a Cuban trainer, and I hope they stick together, because in my opinion, you know, I think the best fight out there that's going to be made is a Cotto Mayweather rematch, in my opinion.
Yeah, and I think, and one of the things I said that I felt like what's going to happen with this fight, I said before the fight, that I think Cotto's going to make it interesting, which is going to set up two more big fights for Mayweather. If he can beat Pacquiao, he can come back, everybody's going to buy this rematch. And for all the reasons that I think, Phil, you pointed out, I think Cotto is, and you notice Mayweather gets on a lot of folks in pre-fight, but this is the opponent I think he's given the most respect I've ever seen all the way to the fight. He said a couple things, but he didn't say much, and that said a lot. The other thing that Cotto needs to do, and I think you put it out, Phil, is that he needs consistency in his life. That's the one thing about Mayweather. His stuff has been the same for a long time, for the most part. The rest of his life might be in chaos, and we'll get into that. But from the boxing standpoint, he's been consistent. He and Roger have been going for a long time. They got a pattern. And I think Cotto needs that kind of – he needs to stick with somebody and go. And I think the trainer he has right now is really good. Game changer. I'll be remiss if I didn't give you an opportunity. And I think Phil kind of led into this a little bit. With the interview with Larry Merchant, Merchant asked about Floyd going away. There's been a lot of comments around Floyd going away. Floyd compared his going to jail to some stuff that I think you want to hit on. What's this greater reaction to how Floyd's depicted his journey into the cell? How do you want to react to that?
Yeah, you should have thrown a no pun intended when you said hit on.
No pun intended. I will say that.
You should have threw that in there. You know, I think I appreciate Michael Eric Dyson doing the interview. If you didn't catch it, Michael Eric Dyson did a pre-fight interview, or they showed some footage of a pre-fight interview that Michael Eric Dyson had done with Floyd. And Floyd talked about, he compared his jail time. And, you know, the actual statement was, you know, Martin Luther King went to jail, Malcolm X went to jail, Floyd Mayweather was going to jail. And, you know, my immediate reaction was, don't compare yourself to those two cats. Don't put yourself in that vein. Just because you're going because you hit your girl. They went on some other stuff. You know, Malcolm was in jail, obviously, for some nefarious things.
Malcolm went on some stuff, but we digress.
Yeah, Malcolm went on some he went in there on some riffraff. But Martin went in on purpose.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? So don't put yourself in that category. But what I will say is that Floyd is occupying a very interesting space in kind of the cultural conversation around race and athletics. Floyd is a bit of a provocateur. And I appreciate him saying that. I don't agree with it, but I appreciate him saying that because I think it allows for a conversation to happen. It allows what I hope happened was, if a father was watching that fight with his son, he had a conversation with that. Now, we know that that may not have happened, but there was an opportunity to have a conversation. Me and my wife had a conversation about the merits of that statement and how we felt about it. And it brought something different into a boxing match. You know, it's a boxing match, but we're talking about, you know, race and the impact of it and African American males and making political statements and how that affects how you're perceived socially, publicly, in the light of the media. So it opened up an opportunity to have a very rich and valuable conversation. As ignorant as I felt it was, and I don't mean ignorant as in ignorant, but just ignorant in the fact that, you know, I think Floyd was aware of what he was really saying. You know, those are two different things. Ignorant and ignorant are two different things. Those that know, know.
And I think even in my debate with Mrs. Game Changer and Tiff, who they all got in on me on Facebook, and so if
you
want to contribute to it.
You got to be careful messing with those two, D, man. You got to call for backup sometimes, partner.
I know I do, and what I had to do, and you got to write this stuff, and so your wife, as everybody knows, is an incredible writer. So not only is she quick on her feet, she's a great writer. So that makes it more difficult because it's a mode of conversation. I'm better on my feet talking, but I had to switch my game up. But part of what I try to talk about Floyd is the issues you raise, I think, are very fair issues for not liking Floyd. And so because I think that comes with the package. And when you make choices like that, those are things you do have to live with. When you are in space like that. And so I think those are fair reasons for folks to be disgusted with Floyd, to have a problem with Floyd. Where I usually hit people back is on when they take that angle and then they start to bring it more into the technical reasons why Floyd going to lose to Pacquiao or somebody else.
Right.
And on a boxing level, and what I said on Facebook, and I said this, I said Floyd is like the really smart kid in the room who acts out so you don't really know he's smart. He tries to disguise the fact that he's really a genius. And so he acts out to deflect it. Now, how he acted out in this situation was more than easy, but some of the stuff he does on the 24/7 and things like that keep you from paying attention to the hard work mantra that really drives him as a boxer. You've never seen him out of shape. You never see him not make weight. You never see him not really trying. Even though you can say he has been inactive at times, you never really see him not do anything. And so from a boxing standpoint, that's hard to argue. As a human being, which I think is the most important evaluation you're going to have, then there are a whole bunch of other issues that you can say about Floyd. And so I think those are things that we need to discuss. I'd love to have some other guests on to kind of get in that and get engage us in that. But as we think about, before we transition into our next segment, I want to say, is Cotto a Hall of Famer? You heard Phil T say that he's a Hall of Famer. Do you see Cotto as a Hall of Famer, and where do you see his next phase of his work going?
I think he's on the verge. I'm not mm-hmm. as sold on. But, you know, I think Phil T, he found a place in Phil T's heart. I'm not there yet with Cotto. But what I will say is that 31, again, given his three losses and given where his main competitors are as far as the Mayweathers and the Pacquiao's, who are – they're not going downhill yet, but they're at their apex. And once you get to your apex, there's really no other place to go but down. I think he is. I think he can step in as one of those guys who begins to kind of take the mantle and run with it, so to speak, as one of the top boxers. I think he's in a position to do that. He's at a young enough age, at 31, where he still has a lot of good boxing ahead of him. He has 5 to 6 years, I think, of solid boxing ahead of him, where, you know, he's going to be in the mix and in the conversation and having some big fights. And I think eventually, you know, he's had some unlucky bouts. He's had some tough situations that he's been put in with the first Margarito fight. If you take that fight out, the only people he's lost to are the two best fighters in the world right now.
Yeah.
You know, I think overall, I think the next fight for him, I don't know if this fight will happen, would be with a Canelo Alvarez.
Yeah.
I think for Alvarez, that's a good fight. Well, I would say I don't think it's a good fight for Alvarez. And this is why, because I think Cotto would put it on him. But I think that's a kind of a fight that if I'm Cotto, I'm going to seek. Because that's a kid who's looking to make a name for himself and trying to take that next step. And Cotto is at that next step. I'd say, you know, we talk about when we have our conversations around football in the NBA, we talk about that top tier of guys. We have a Pacquiao and a Mayweather. Cotto's right there, right underneath him. He's not quite in that tier yet, because he still has to. You got to beat one of them to get up there, I think. And he gave Floyd all he could handle, but I think he's right there. You know, if you got one and one A, he's right there at two. You know, he's right there at two, hanging in there. So I think he's on the trajectory to be a Hall of Fame boxer. Do I think he's there yet? No, I still think he has to get one of those greats. He has to catch one of those guys one night and give it to him to cement it. You know, the foundation is being laid, but to cement it, I think he's going to catch one of those guys.
All right, good points for the game, Terry. Well, we're going to move into our next segment. Y'all know what it is.
Five on the black hand side.
So for five on the black hand side, we are bringing home, we are bringing in our NBA guy, Justin Page. How you doing tonight, Justin?
Fellas, glad to be here, man. How y'all doing tonight?
We doing good, Justin. Before we jump into the NBA talk, we got to ask you, is Cotto a Hall of Famer?
I got a theory about that, Phil T. If you have to ask the question, the answer is no. If I ask you, is Floyd Mayweather a Hall of Famer, you wouldn't even think about it, would you?
You're right.
43-0, 43 have stepped up, 43 have stepped down. Pacquiao, you'll even give him a little credit, even though he's had some Fugazi losses. Cotto is not a Hall of Famer, and he's not going to be one until he beats Floyd or Pacquiao. Why was Sugar Ray Leonard so phenomenal in his day? He was a small guy who beat Marvin Hagler. Buster Douglas, he's not even a Hall of Famer, but he beat Mike Tyson, so he gets consideration. But you got to ask the question. If you got to ask the question, you're not in. He's got time, though.
So that's the warm-up line.
Don't get me wrong.
Line.
No disrespect to you and your man crush with Cotto. I understand. He fought Floyd better than anybody else has fought Floyd. However, Floyd still gave that man a beatdown of his life.
All right, so that's the warm-up line. That's the warm-up line, okay? We just did a three-man weave to get JP warmed up. Justin, the NBA... And, you know, I'm going to smooth move past that one because he disagreed with me, but I'm going to keep it moving. So just the NBA is going to announce their all-NBA first team and second team in a couple of days. But we're going to come to you first. Tell us about your all-NBA first team.
Understood. Please don't take me disagreeing with you any type of way. I disagree with probably half the people on the show right now and half the listeners. That's just who I am. But,
yes, sir.
You know, it's all about healthy debate. But you want to talk about first team All-NBA, I think that I'm going to start with my forwards. I think that they're undisputable. I don't think we'll have any issues here. I think being game changer, obviously we've had a history of clashing in the past. I think we'll both agree that the forwards should be LeBron James and Kevin Durant. You got one LeBron James self-titled king, who's three-time MVP at this point. I'll go ahead and give it to him for this year, which I did on the last show. I don't need to say more about LeBron James. I mean, if he's not first-team All-NBA, I don't know who is.
Right.
Second forward, Kevin Durant, three-time scoring champ in a row. You know, Kobe gave him a pass by sitting out the last game and not challenging him to get that scoring title, but Kevin Durant is head over heels better than any other forward in the game, not named LeBron James, and I think that's a given there. There's no argument. There's no dispute. I dare anybody to challenge me on that regard. All right? I'm going to go down to the guards. Gets a little questionable at the guards. Well, for one guard at least. I don't think anybody would argue with me. I say Kobe Bryant, who's second in the NBA in scoring, averaging 28 points a game in his 16th season in the NBA. He even did an interview and said, 16 years is a long time. I don't know how much I got left in my tank. But I think he showed you this year how much he had left in his tank by almost taking the scoring title and leading the Lakers to a third seed in a very, very difficult Western Conference. So I got Kobe Bryant as my first guard. And I really struggled with my point guard for my first All-NBA team. It could have been Russell Westbrook. leading the Thunder to the second seed overall. Could have been Chris Paul, who increased the Clippers' win percentage by over 40 percentage points. It could have been Rajon Rondo, who averages 13 assists a game, led the league in steals and assists, led the Celtics to win the Atlantic Division. However, when all things are equal, I go to overall team record. Tony Parker is the leader on his team. Tony Parker is the catalyst of the Spurs offense. Tony Parker is Greg Popovich on the floor. Tony Parker is my first team All-NBA point guard. I know we'll have some discussion about it, but I'm a believer. 18 points a game, 7 assists a game. That 18 points is 2 points higher than his career average, and those 7.7 assists a game are 2 assists higher than his career average. So he's elevated his game this year, given the shortened season, given the old, historic, ancient players that he's playing with. Tony Parker is my point guard on the All-NBA first team. And last but not least, the final spot at the center spot goes to no other than the individual game changer and I had much discussion about last time I was on this call, Mr. Andrew Bynum. Third in the NBA in field goal percentage. First time All-Star, 4.3 blocks per game. 18 points, 12 boards, playing behind Kobe Bryant, who was trigger happy this year. Kobe averaged 5 more shots than anybody else in the league. 5 more shots per game than Kevin Durant. 6 more than LeBron James. Anybody who shot the ball a lot, Kobe outdid him. And Andrew Bynum still managed to average a double-double, still managed to have 18 points a game, still managed to average a double-double, and led the league in block shots. Andrew Bynum beat out Dwight Howard for my All-NBA first team.
All right, so I'm popping it right back into the post with you. Can you quickly go to your All-NBA second team?
Absolutely. Second team is a little more debatable, but I like my choices here. I started with the forwards on the first team, so I'll go forwards on the second team. I got Kevin Love to lead it all. He led the NBA with 48 double-doubles, 26 points per game, 13 boards. The man is a beast. Yeah, his team stinks, and I'm a big advocate for team success when I look at all NBA teams. However, this guy can't be denied. Kevin Love was my if his team would have done a little bit better, he would have challenged Kevin Durant to some degree. Let me not go overboard here, but he's definitely my second team all NBA. I think that he is great. A great future for the Minnesota Timberwolves building around him. I also like to look at Blake Griffin for my number two. You know, given the success him and Chris Paul has had, you know, Blake went to 20 points a game this year, 11 rebounds, averaged a double-double, led the NBA in highlight dunks. I think that there's no better power forward, you know, arguably LaMarcus Aldridge, but he got hurt towards the end of the year. At the end of the day, there's no two better forwards than Kevin Love and Blake Griffin other than my first team All-NBAers. All right? Moving forward, we're going down to my guards. Either one of these two guards could have made the first team. I'm going with Chris Paul, and I'm going with Rajon Rondo. As I mentioned earlier, Rondo, 13 assists per game, led the NBA. 3.6 steals a game, led the NBA. Won the Atlantic Division. Let me give you guys a stat. I know Game Changer likes stats. 27 games in a row, still counting to this day, Rajon Rondo's had double-digit assists. I don't know the last player to have done that. I couldn't even find the research on it. It's so phenomenal. So he definitely was a first-team nod, but I had to put him on a second team behind Parker and Bryant. Chris Paul, we all know what he's done this year, 20 points a game, 9 assists, 5th in steals. I mean, and what he did for the Clippers, he changed the organization. They're getting ready. I can't wait for this matchup between Chris Paul and Tony Parker in the next round. Last but not least, my center, Dwight Howard. He could have been first team given his stats, 20.6 points a game, 14.5 rebounds, 2.1 blocks. My only problem with Dwight is his off-the-field, off-the-court issues. for lack of a better term. I don't think he handled this free agency debacle. I don't think he handled it well. I think he could have handled it much better. I think he should either opted out or sign for the long term. I think he hurt himself by signing a one-year deal. He hurt himself financially. I think he hurt himself in the public eye, and I think he burned the Orlando Magic. He should have either left or he should have stayed for the long haul, and he didn't do either, which that hurt him, and then missing the last 10 games of the season, that hurt him as well. He statistically, he was better than Andrew Bynum, but his team success was poor. The way he handled himself off the floor was poor, and I don't know what we're going to get from Dwight moving forward. That's why he's on my second team.
So you're listening to the Real Sports Guys on RealSportsGuys.com. Our NBA guy, Justin Page, just dropped his All-NBA first team and second team. Before I bring the game changer, and I'm going to quickly recap Justin's first and second All-NBA team. Second team, Chris Paul, Rondo, Kevin Love, Blake Griffith, Dwight Howard. First team, Tony Parker, Kobe Bryant, LeBron James, Kevin Durant, and Bynum. Game changer. You got any issue with this list?
I get JP going with Tony Parker on the first team. I know that rubs a lot of people the wrong way. Honestly, it's hard to argue with. I think you could make an argument for Russell Westbrook in that spot. I probably would have put Russie in that spot. But what I will say is that something that, he says I like stats. I don't like stats that much, but I just like stats because everybody don't see the game the way we see the game, so stats help. Numbers help everybody relate. And so Tony Parker, the numbers that JP read off with the 18 points, 7 assists, almost 50% shooting, people have to understand he does that with 32 minutes a night.
Yeah.
32 minutes a night, which is remarkable because if he were – on any other team other than the Spurs, he'd probably be playing 36 to 37 minutes. That additional 4 to 5 minutes is probably another, 4 or 5 points, maybe another assist. So he's averaging, 23-8. So I probably would have went with Russie, but I can see Tony in that spot because Tony has had an amazing season. It's gone under the radar just because of the way San Antonio carries themselves and San Antonio really isn't it's a small market, but it's not really a small market. It just doesn't get a lot of attention. It's not sexy. But San Antonio has had a great season, and he's been the straw that has stirred that drink. So I don't have a problem with that. I give a salute to JP for having Bynum on that first team. I totally agree with him on that one. The one point of contention that I think I'm going to have to stand my ground on is Blake on the second team. And I disagree on that one. I would have went with a Dirk or even an Al Jefferson, who had an amazingly efficient year. I think my gripe with Blake right now is that he's somewhat limited offensively. I think Chris Paul is carrying that squad. Blake is helping out, which is great. It doesn't affect how I view Blake's upside. I still think Blake has a lot of upside. I think he'll get there. I don't think he's there yet. I think he's a little bit limited offensively. We kind of had this conversation last night over text. I know D. Wills, he kind of is in this camp as well. I'm just feeling like Blake isn't quite there yet offensively. I think he's going to work to get there. I think he'll get there before Dwight gets there.
I'm throwing a shot.
I'm throwing a shot. I'm going to throw some darts at Dwight. Because I like to. Again, Dwight, if you're listening and you don't like it, call in. That's all I got to say.
Ask Justin. Let me bring Justin in. So Justin, why Blake over Al Jefferson or Dirk?
I'm going to tell you why. Look at Blake's team success. Look at Blake's success. Blake's on his second year. Al Jeff averaged 19.2 points a game. Blake averaged 20.7. Al Jeff averaged 9.6 points a game. I got to round up to give him a double-double. I don't have to do that.
Memphis got a garbage roster. And the fact that they were even in the playoffs, I guarantee nobody
on here right now
in the playoffs. Nobody on here had Utah in the playoffs.
Exactly. They shouldn't even made the playoffs. So,
but they did.
I put Blake ahead of Al, Jeff, given that they shouldn't even made the playoffs. They lucked up to get there. So, and as I told you about Tony Parker over Chris Paul and Rondo, I got to put team success, that's part of my evaluation. You take Blake Griffin off the Clippers, I don't think they're as successful as they were this year. Utah Jazz don't make the playoffs at all. However,
the Clippers are as good as the Hornets were, and CP got them to the playoffs.
I'm sorry?
Hey, well, you take Blake Griffin off the Clips, and they're as good as the Hornets were last year. And CP3 got that squad, that raggedy squad, to the playoffs.
That's debatable.
But he did.
Al Jeff has been who he's been since he's been in the league. He hasn't been on first. He hasn't made Matter of fact, has he made an All Star game?
They are who we thought they were.
He made maybe one.
They
or
are
two.
Who we thought they were. They are
Al
who we
Jeff,
thought.
But
they
did he have a better season than Blake this year?
He did.
That's
look
the
at the numbers. You like numbers. You call me out about numbers with AI. My first call, and now you want to go against numbers?
No, I'm not going against the numbers. If you look at the numbers, I think Jefferson was a more efficient player.
What are you basing on? It's not points per game. It's not rebounds. It's not blocks. It's not team success. What are you looking at? Field goal percentage?
Oh, their teams were what? They were separated by like 20 points. I mean, what? The
I know
Clippers
one,
were like
one is in the playoffs still, and one is not. One got swept,
right,
and the other is about to win in five.
Right, but are the Clippers still in the playoffs because of Blake?
Yes, absolutely.
Yes.
Absolutely. Blake had 30 last night.
I'm not buying that one.
Blake had 30
last night.
He fouled out and he still had 30.
Did you see what CP3 did last night?
Did Al Jeff make the All Star game this year?
Nah, he don't have that's not Blake is gonna make All Star teams just like Yao was making All Star. Blake is gonna make All Star teams. Blake is gonna make more All Star teams than Al Jeff.
And why is that? Because he stinks and he can dunk?
No, because
he's that
player.
Talented of
Blake
a guy.
Don't get me wrong. I'm not saying that Blake sucks. I'm not saying sucks at all. I'm saying Blake is a very good player. I don't think he's second-team All-NBA at this point in his career. Is he going to be second-team All-NBA, first-team All-NBA? Abso-friggin-lutely. Abso-friggin-lutely. But is he there this year? I think this year, again, I look at Dirk or Al Jefferson just as much as I would Blake. I'm not sold on Blake as a second-team All-NBA guy right now. Right now, today, at this point in his career, I'm not sold on it. Because, again, he still is a liability late in games because he can't shoot free throws.
All right, so we've had some very spirited debate between the game changer and Justin Page. We're going to continue this after our break. When we go take a break from the live show, which is going to end here in about 8 minutes, and then we'll go into the after show. The after hours for a good 20 or 30 minutes. I encourage folks that are listening live, feel free to download the show on iTunes or go to our website at realsportsguys.com about 15 or 20 minutes after the show ends to hear the after hours. We're going to pay some bills and get a word from our sponsor.
Now we're going to get into our Resistance Digital Dog of the Week. Resistance Digital Solutions. Are you tired of running to the boys in blue? Are you done with listening to sales staff trying to upsell you technology that you don't need? We've all been there. So, what did the Real Sports Guys do? We contacted Resistance Digital Solutions for all our technology needs. They are not there to meet sales quotas or make profit margins. They simply just want to sell you what you need at a fair price. From iPads to PCs to flat screens, TVs, or intricate home theater systems, they customize every solution based on your needs. Check out their website at www.resistancedigital.com or email them at sales@resistancedigital.com for your custom technology solutions today.
A word from our sponsors, Resistance Digital. Check them out at resistancedigital.com. Fellas, let's do Dogs of the Week. D. Wills, who you got for your Dog of the Week?
I was about to say cocaine because he had just entered the building, but I would be remiss if I did, in the spirit of Dr. Sack, to not have this person as our dog of the week. Shaq, who earned his doctorate officially, he went through commencement here in May. He earned his PhD, or his, he may have an EDD now, in education, and he had a 3.8 average. And these are things, you know, this is on the back page. And his capstone project was explored how CEOs and business leaders use humor in the workplace. Shaq is my dog of the week.
Game changer. Who you got for your dog of the week?
For my dog of the week, I am going with Doug Collins. Doug Collins, I think, has done a masterful job of keeping that young squad in Philly focused. He's done a great job of helping them not relax. You know, one thing that young teams like to do is they like to relax. When a star goes down, when Derrick Rose gets hurt, it's like, okay, all right, we got this. They got us out. We got this. Philly didn't do that. They kept chugging away. They kept plugging away. They know it went down. They still didn't relax. So now they're at a position where they can wrap the series up tonight. As much as it hurts to see Derrick Rose be hurt as a Chicagoan at heart, I have to give my hats off to Doug Collins. You know, hopefully he can see this thing through. He always does this, turns around a young squad, gets them going well, but he has a style that grates on players after a while, and it does lose its effectiveness. Hopefully he can change a little bit so he can hang around for a little bit longer. So hats off to Doug Collins this week.
My dog of the week, I'm going with Floyd Money Mayweather. He did his thing this past weekend. You know, Justin as well as Marcus have pointed out the affinity that I have for Miguel Cotto. But, you know, I got to give it up for money, for the whole money team. Well, not the whole money
even
team.
Even B? I'll yeah. say even B?
Nah. Let's strike that one from the record. Not the money team, okay? Because you know that team. That team is going to be the demise of Floyd in 20 years, okay, while he's probably still boxing. But I'm going to give it up to the money man, Money Mayweather. So that is my dog of the week. So, fellas, let's slide into what we got going on next week. Next week, the fellas and I, we are taking the week off, okay? We are taking a vacation. RSG is taking a week off. And what we're going to do is we're going to slap together some of our classic shows. You know, some of you all have been exposed to us over the past couple of months as a result of some of the guests that we've had on, but we want to help catch everybody up and talk a little bit about some of the guests that we've had on previously. In that spirit, we're going to queue up an interview we had with TJ Duckett a couple of weeks ago that he talked a little bit about the bounty situation. Here you go, a teaser.
Yeah, obviously you've played in the NFL, you're familiar, you played football, you played on both sides of the ball. Provide us with your perspective on this issue.
You know, and I caught the last tell bit of what you guys are talking about, but I do agree with what you said. When it comes to a person's livelihood, when it comes to physically hurt somebody intentionally, I can't agree with that. But interception, big play, something like that, it's an incentive amongst teams. Like you said, you got stickers. In high school, in junior high, in the playground, you got the girls' attention. I mean, you got to make plays, and football. Football's a brutal sport. It's a barbarian sport. I mean, when I ran the ball, my job, I wanted to punish you, and if that meant, you know, you getting a headache, you something happening to you, you getting hurt. That's part of what my job, my running style was. Now, I wouldn't want anything to happen after the 60 minutes and on the street, but within the lines, you know, you got to go out and be that warrior. So it's hard to separate the two, but if you're going to intentionally hurt somebody, I can't agree with that.
Now, you played on some good teams. Did you have that folks who on the defense or whatever that had those kind of competitive things they put with each other? Was that things that on offer you knew folks talking about?
I mean, yeah, even like as kids. I mean, who's the first person to go down on a kickoff. First person, who's the first person to touch the ball carrier? Whatever it was back then, it might have been you get a donut. You know what I'm saying? But as a kid, you could instill it. That's part of the game, is to go and we highlight the most physical, the most dangerous, the most meanest competitor. We highlight that. So
that's
now
right.
That it's brought to light, it's like, oh, how could they? But you glorify the big hits, and you glorify all this, and you want to see that. So, I mean, I don't recommend, and I'm not with intentionally going to hurt somebody. But it's like, that's like saying, tell Michael Jordan you can't dunk all games because you're too good. You know, I mean, that's just, he'll go and he'll dunk every play if possible, but you can't do that. So that's how I look at it.
All right, so that was a teaser for the classic show that we'll have going on next week. Again, we're going to move into the after hours here in about 30 seconds, but before that, I'm going to swing it over to the Game Changer.
All right. So, we're going into the after hours. Make sure you check us out. Don't hold you down. Come back in. We're going to have some more basketball conversation with my man Justin Page. You listen to the Real Sports Guys, the Real Guys Talk Real Sports. RSB Renegade Radio. Make sure you check us out next week. Hit us up, realsportsguys.com, Renegade Radio. Hit us up on Facebook. Check us out on Twitter. Have a blessed evening. Make sure you check us out next week, 8:30 to 10:30 Tuesday night. Peace. All right, welcome back to Real Guys with Real Guys Talk Real Sports. Guys with Real Guys Talk Real Sports. RSG Renegade Radio, www.realsportsguys.com. This is the after hours section of the show. Welcome. We're going to hold you down for about 20 to a half hour right now. We're going to jump right back in. We had some real heated, real lively and animated basketball banter going on between myself and our special guest, Justin Page, who is joining us. He is our resident hoops junkie. He comes on every once in a while to get us updated on what's going on in the NBA, a place we like to call the League of Extraordinary Gentlemen. And he likes to get us updated and give us a fresh perspective on what's going on in the league. Before, earlier on in the show, Justin came in and he gave us his All-NBA teams. Now we want to bring Justin back in and have him check in with us on some thoughts about the playoffs and some of the series that are going on. The first series I want Justin to touch base with us on is one that we kind of started talking about before when we were talking about Blake Griffin, but the Memphis Grizzlies versus the Los Angeles Clippers. Justin, what's your take on that series? And after you go into the Grizzlies and Clippers, just give us some other series that you're interested in.
Phenomenal series. NBA couldn't have had a better matchup. I think out of all of the series that are being played right now, I believe this is the most competitive. However, the 3-1 doesn't really indicate how competitive it's been. But if you look at the margin of victory for each team, I think it shows you that the two teams are equally matched. I would argue that the Clippers stole the Grizzlies' heart when they came back from 21 in the fourth quarter. If you look 1 through 8 on paper, player for player, my money would have been on the Grizzlies all day. However, Chris Paul being the best player on the court has had a far bigger impact. I don't think Michael Conley Jr. can hold Chris Paul's jockstrap, and I think that's the difference in this series. Another difference I want to point out, Mark Gasol. Last year in the playoffs, he was a double-double guy, surefire 20 points, 10 rebounds. This guy is averaging 10.6 rebounds in this series. It's not enough. His regular season average, 14.69 rebounds. He's cut both of those numbers damn near in half. I don't know if I want to credit DeAndre Jordan or Blake Griffin for the defense on him, but he's the reason. Michael Conley Jr. not being able to guard Chris Paul and Mark Gasol not coming through is the reason why the Clippers are getting ready to beat them in 5. I like Memphis' chances tomorrow night at home, but I'm not quite sold. You know, yeah, Z-Bo and Gasol, Z-Bo's holding his own, but I think that he's somewhat ruined the chemistry coming back from his injury when he did. I don't think he was quite ready. I think Lionel Hollins putting him in the starting lineup just to start the playoffs, and he didn't start all season long given his injury. I think that kind of threw the team for a loop. And, you know, last year they had much success without Rudy Gay. Now they had to read Rudy Gay back into it. And, you know, Rudy Gay, Z-Bo, and Gasol haven't had that much chemistry on the court thus far, whereas the Clippers have had all season long to gel. And they've got, like I said, the best player in Chris Paul. I really think that the Clippers are bound to do greatness this year. Whether that's the semifinals of the Western Conference or whether that's even the conference finals, I think the Clippers are bound to beat the Grizzlies. If they don't win tomorrow night in Memphis, I think they're going to do it in 6, and I can't wait to see Chris Paul play Tony Parker in the next round.
Excellent. Now, I'm going to toss it to D. Wills because he has some strong opinions. Given that we're talking about the Clippers and the Grizzlies series, he has some strong opinions on the impact of Blake Griffin and how he's playing in this series and Blake's overall evolution as a go-to guy for this team. So I want to talk to the D. Wills and let him have at it for a moment.
Yeah, and I've been going back and forth. For those of you who've been on our Facebook page at facebook.com/RealSportsGuysRadio, you should check it out. We've been going back and forth on this. And I really think the problem that is with Memphis is really on how they're playing defense. And I think, Game Changer, you hit it right on, that I think in some ways it's fool's gold and it's smoke and mirrors around Blake Griffin, that he hasn't really developed any clear post moves, that I think he was 10 for 15, and probably about 6 of those baskets came on putbacks or lobs. But if you watch him play in the post, he doesn't have any – he has terrible footwork. We've been going back and forth on Twitter around that. He doesn't have any signature moves that I think are credible. And the better teams are going to single cover him and force him to make shots that I don't think he can make. And if you look at last night, I couldn't understand why Memphis would come down a double team and allow him to kick it out to a three-point shooter. It was those. If you look at those threes down the stretch, they killed him, and there was no reason for them to come off and double Blake and allow those shooters to stay open. And I think people are fooled into that. But when you see them go up against the Popoviches of the world in terms of the Spurs, you see them go up against the Lakers or Oklahoma City, you're going to see more single covers because they understand it. It's almost like fool's gold. And that's part of why I don't see Blake as a second-team All-NBA star. I agree it might have been Dirk. It could have been some other ones. And I'm not saying this, that he's not emerging. But I think that even to his credit, he's doing it with smoke and mirrors. And where you're going to see it show up is against some of these better teams who are going to single cover him, force him to be a post player, a true post player, where he's going to struggle.
Justin, response, rebut.
y'all keep referencing Dirk. Did you not recall Dirk had to take 5 to 6 games off in the middle of the season because of his first half of the season he stunk so bad? Are y'all that much of a creature of the moment that you can't remember the beginning of the season? Dirk stunk. He was on my fantasy team. I almost traded him for a scrub, for Ryan Anderson, for that matter, because Dirk could not get it done the first half of the season. He took a week off just to get his legs back because he wasn't in shape. Dirk was shooting 30-something percent from the field and was barely getting 15 points a game. Dirk hasn't turned it on to the last month of the season. There's no way. Dirk admitted himself that he could not be an all-star this year. They voted him on because he's Dirk. But he said himself, I should not be an all-star this year because I'm not producing like I have in the past. How are y'all putting this guy against a guy who was averaging a double-double? What do y'all have
but
against
Blake? But I would tell you, even LaMarcus Aldridge got hurt at the end of the season. So if you're looking at even judging on the season, what LaMarcus got hurt towards the end of the season. He had a hell of a season. Are you saying that that Blake is better than LaMarcus? I don't think so.
If you listen to me in the last segment, I said arguably the best power forward, not named LaMarcus Aldridge. I love LaMarcus Aldridge. If he didn't get hurt, he may have been up there. However, his team success was limited. They didn't make the playoffs, and he missed the last couple weeks of the regular season, which is the only reason I put Blake above LaMarcus. I love LaMarcus.
Let me ask you this. If you put Kevin Love, even Dirk, how you describe Dirk, and you slot Dirk into that Clippers team, you might say they are a finals contender.
I disagree. Couldn't disagree with you more.
If you want to put Dirk in that lineup, you're giving me Dirk
career-wise. I'm going on this year alone, buddy. I'm going on this year alone. If you look at Dirk's numbers this year, didn't step up into the last half of the season. I'm going the entire year here. Blake Griffin was a stud this year. You can't deny that man that. Blake Griffin was fourth. He was fourth in the entire NBA in double doubles.
I'm gonna tell you right now, if they could make the call right now to put Dirk in that lineup, Dirk, get on the plane, come.
They don't do it.
They would break.
So you're telling me right now, you're a general manager. You're trading Blake Griffin, who's been in the league 2 years, for a 14-year veteran in Dirk Nowitzki, who's probably on his last leg. That's what you're going to do?
But if this is a guy you just put on the second team, we're talking about second team All-NBA. You just put him on
absolutely
second team All-NBA.
Absolutely.
I tell you that he's not second team All-NBA. That's what I was saying.
So you think Dirk's going to make the second team All-NBA? Who's your second team All-NBA? Give it to me, please.
I'm saying that's the only one I'm disagreeing on you. I'm saying even an injured LaMarcus Aldridge I'm putting in on the second team. Because he got injured at the end of the season. But he still, for his performance, I'm still putting him in there before I put Blake.
I want y'all to book me right now for the day that the NBA first and second team come out. I want y'all to book me right now. I'll sign the contract. Where do I sign?
Consider it done.
Book me.
Matter of fact, just call in. You just call in. We'll get you on.
I think this is ludicrous. I'll tell you what. You know who I put in before I put in Dirk and before I put in Al Jefferson?
Mm-hmm.
Josh Smith.
That's a good one. I thought about going there.
Before I called in the show, I said my honorable mentions at forward are Tim Duncan and Josh Smith. And I'll put Josh Smith over Al Jefferson and Dirk Nowitzki based on this year and this year only.
I don't disagree.
I would argue with you on that. I mean, I wouldn't argue with you on that one at all either. I think now you coming home. That's why I want to bring it home.
So y'all just don't respect Blake at all.
No, I don't have a problem with Blake.
Seem like you got a problem with Blake.
Nah.
Both of y'all. I'm being honest. Seem like you got a problem with him.
You're a regular listener, man. You got to go check the tape, man. I'm the one who went to bat for Blake for the Team USA.
I don't like him on Team USA. I don't think his game translates internationally.
I bought the big dogs out.
I don't think his game translates internationally.
It doesn't. It doesn't. But my reasoning was is because the marketing and what Blake brings as far as excitement, as far as promoting the NBA, he's going to be on the team. And he needs to be on the team because of that.
Understood. We got enough marketing. We got LeBron. We got Kobe. We got D-Wade. You know, we got enough.
You're talking about the right people, man. You can't never have enough marketing, dog. You can't never have enough. Marketing equals money.
We need to win the game.
How this world works. They're going to win the games. They're going to win the games.
Hey, that's what we said a couple years back, and we weren't winning the games. When
that's
the
true,
AI
we
got
taking
third place
over there. That's what we were taking an ill-formed team over there.
I like AI, Steph.
Listen, we're talking about practice. Not a game. We're talking about practice.
It's 20.
We're celebrating the 10-year anniversary of the practice rant. I love it. Real sports guy.
Yo, God.
Did y'all see him today? I mean, yesterday in China, he threw the ball between the guy's legs. Nah, nobody caught that highlight?
Nah, man.
All right, let me not get off subject. Let's go. I'm not the point guard here. I tweeted it out earlier, though. Check me out, Justin Page 80 on Twitter. I tweeted it out for everybody to see AI's highlight in China just yesterday.
That's your guy, though, huh?
Absolutely.
So, Justin, while we have you on, I want to get your thoughts on the favorites. You may have a sleeper favorite, but I know right now the general consensus is there are three kind of favorites. And in no particular order, I'm going to rattle off these names. The Heat, the Oklahoma City Thunder, and San Antonio right now seem to be the favorites. Now, what I'd like you to do is give me your assessment of those three teams and where they are right now. And if you got a sleeper, then give us a sleeper.
Okay. Well, I think you guys have talked to me enough to know who my sleeper is. I'll wait till I address the first three. So I had a feeling this question was coming, so I'm going to call this the JP Power Rankings. Out of those three favorites, my number one, and I can't believe I'm hearing myself say this myself, is the San Antonio Spurs. I'm quoting Kenny Smith here. I was listening the other night watching highlights. They're not settling for good shots. They're getting great shots. Their side-to-side ball movement has defenses flustered. Not just the Utah Jazz. I mean, they're on an 11-game winning streak dating back to the regular season. They're getting guys like Matt Bonner, Steven Jackson, Boris Diaw, quality shots while moving the basketball. Their unselfishness is unparalleled in the league. Tony Parker is getting to the lane at will. Tim Duncan looks like he looked in 96 when they won their first championship. I really like what they're doing right now. Their bench scored 57 points last night, which is a league record. The playoffs are all about matchups, but from a power ranking standpoint, from a starting five, from a bench, from coaching, from fundamentals, you know, it's the most boring style of basketball, don't get me wrong, but the San Antonio Spurs are head and heels above the rest right now, and I hate to say it because I don't want to see them in the championship. All right, that's number one. My number two in the JP Power Rankings are the Oklahoma City Thunder. I love how they closed out the defending champion Dallas Mavericks. Game one and two were a little bit tight. They played a little tentative, but they really turned it up when they went on the road, and that's what it takes to be a champion. You have to be able to win on the road. I think they'll struggle with L.A. in round three, but I think they're going to end up winning at the end of the day. They were 2-1 against L.A. in the regular season. The two wins that they had were 14 points or more, meaning there were two blowouts. The one loss that they had to L.A. was when Meta World Peace went Ron Artest on James Harden and gave that man a concussion. So number two on my power rankings is the Thunder. I love what they're doing right now. I would love to see a Thunder-Spurs conference finals. I think it'll go 7. I can't even give you a prediction because they're so equally matched. And number three, the Miami Heat. Games 1 through 3, I love their intensity. I love their defensive pressure. I love their game plan. However, I'm one of the biggest Carmelo fans out there, and I don't like how they let Carmelo torch him as much as he torched him. Even though he shot the ball poorly, I think that the 40-point game, the 30-plus point game, shows a weakness in the Heat that they don't want to put the kill zone on. I think that they had the ability to shut teams out, and they don't do it when it's important. And I think that's a lack of character from a team perspective. You know, I like the Heat to ease through the East because there's no competition now that Derrick Rose is hurt, but I don't trust them to beat whomever comes out of the West, whether it be Los Angeles, Oklahoma City, or San Antonio.
Now, your sleeper. Who's your sleeper?
The Los Angeles Lakers, ladies and gentlemen. You've heard me time and time again. I've got two Los Angeles Lakers on my first team, All-NBA. I mentioned this before. The Thunder has James Harden, Kevin Durant, Russell Westbrook. Boston Celtics have Kevin Garnett, Rajon Rondo, Paul Pierce, Ray Allen. All these teams got big threes, big fours. But I don't trust another big three more than I trust the game's best closer in Kobe Bryant, the longest 1-2 punch in Pau Gasol and Andrew Bynum. My sleeper is the Los Angeles Lakers. I think that Oklahoma City has enough to beat them, but I would never cut out the Lakers. And I think the Lakers match up best with San Antonio, and they have a chance to win this title. I said it last show. I said it the show before that. I can't count out Kobe Bryant until Kobe's retired. That's my bias. I'm sorry. That's my sleeper.
Now, I got a couple questions for you about the teams. Now, it looks like the Heat are going to face off with the Indiana Pacers. Can you handicap that match? Give us your perspective on that matchup. Is that a good matchup for the Heat in the next round? Are the Heat going to just – because the Pacers could present some problems. It's interesting. I just think it's a very interesting matchup. I don't know how it's going to go. I don't really have an opinion either way, but I'm sure you do. So what's your opinion on that particular potential series?
I couldn't disagree with you more. I would almost bet you right now all the money in my pocket that the Heat are going to sweep them boys. I don't trust the Indiana Pacers as far as I can see them. They don't have a closer. Their coach said today, we don't have a go-to guy. We've got go-to plays. And I don't trust a team with no go-to guys when you're playing against LeBron James and Dwayne Wade. I think the Heat will sweep through the East. I think that their biggest challenge is going to be the Boston Celtics in the conference finals. But the Heat, they're going to blow through Indiana. I'm surprised they didn't sweep the Knicks. Like, what are they going to do, force the ball down low to Roy Hibbert? I don't trust Hibbert in a clutch situation. Love Hibbert's game. Don't get me wrong. He's progressed. Georgetown graduate. I watched him in D.C. But he has no business trying to play against the Miami Heat. I think Charles Barkley said the other night that Indiana has the players from David West, Danny Granger on the wings to contest the Heat's wing players. Are you kidding me? Danny Granger on LeBron James? Who you taking?
I think this is a watershed moment for Granger. Either he's going to show he can be a big boy or he's going to have to stay at the little kid's table. That's what I think is going to be interesting. Again, I don't know how I feel about it either way.
I know how I feel. You're in between. I'm sold. It'll be a sweep. Mark my words. That 16 on LeBron James' mouthpiece. Look, I'm going to tell you this. LeBron James is licking his chops at the Indiana Pacers. He's saying that game recognized game, and Indiana looks unfamiliar.
I like it. D-Wills, how are you? D-Wills, give me your assessment. What do you think about that potential matchup now that the Pacers have wrapped up Magic in a nice, pretty package and put a bow on them, sent them off fishing? How do you see the Heat and Pacers matching up with one another?
I think Joshua makes an interesting point because I think people get really excited about these first round matchups. And styles and matchups make these playoff series. And there's certain things you can take from these first-round matchups, but there's certain things you can't take as you move in. And I'm not sure. I mean, I the one thing we know about Indiana is they're going to play hard. They're going to play physical. And I think that's going to be a challenge for Miami to deal with. I don't know. I don't think it's going to be a sweep, because I just think that Indiana, the way they approach the game is they play so hard, I think they'll get one or two games just on that effort. But I think it's just another opportunity for Miami to mature. I think Miami's biggest – I think it could be a sweep, but I think the games are going to be so close. And Miami has not defined how they're going to close games. And I think against I think against Indiana, that's going to be a problem. And I think that's the series that's going to help them. They're either going to figure out how to close these games out, or they're going to have a much longer series than they need to. So I see it going maybe five or six, just because I think Indiana has enough there. But I agree with you. I think this is an opportunity for Granger and some of these players who I think they're on the verge of being stars to show up. But I also, you know, one thing I think about Miami's good bullying the unfamiliar, and I think that's where you kind of lead the door against something like Indiana. They struggle against the other bullies. That's where they struggle. But they're good with bullying, you know, like they did against some of the teams last year, bullying teams that they think they can just get over. But it's going to be a tougher series than people anticipate. I just don't think Indiana's got enough firepower down the stretch to win it all.
Okay. Hey, I just wanted to throw that out there real quick, get some perspective on it. Now, Justin talked about the Lakers. He talked about the Lakers as his fourth sleeper. How you feel about that, D. Wills?
I don't think the Lakers are asleep. I mean, and I said it before. I said they're every team has warts. And as we learned from about San Antonio last year, San Antonio had the best record last year, and then their warts showed up late. I think they're a much better team this year. I think the wart for them is going to be in that they're going to be exposed by that size. And I think what I like about the Lakers is that you can't teach height, and their big guys are beginning to play, and Bynum is quietly growing up. And where he's growing up is on the defensive end. And having somebody who can protect the basket and give them a low post game is allowing Kobe to be efficient. And so by the time they reach some of these other players, they'll have Meta back, so they'll get a little bit deeper. I think they're formidable. I don't think they're a sleeper. I think they're formidable. When you look at everyone else, when all these other teams have warts, I think that they have the one thing or two things that these other teams don't have. They got Bynum and Gasol, size that you just can't coach against.
Yeah. And this is what I was getting at last night when I texted you that. We talked about the Clippers missing Chauncey and the value that Chauncey added. And I texted you back saying that without Chauncey, the Clippers don't create any mismatches. And you've said it several times is that a lot of what goes on in the playoffs is about matchups and creating matchups in your favor. And I think that's what the Lakers can do. The Thunder have a very versatile roster where they can mix and match different lineups and create problems. I think that's what it's all about, is having a versatile enough roster where you don't get locked into only being successful playing a certain way or playing with certain guys on the court. And you can throw different things at teams to give them something new to react to or to put them in a position where they're compromised. San Antonio has that. Miami has that. Go ahead.
The one thing I want to add, because you just hit a really good point, and I trust your perspective on this, is I think the one thing I worry about the Thunder, because as we get into these elite teams, so winning the championship means you got to go through elite teams. People who know how to play basketball in a seven-game series, right? I still don't know if Durant is a closer in those elite games, meaning against elite defensive teams, Durant tends to get pushed farther and farther away from the basket in clutch time. And if you look at some of the best closers who are going to be left, people like Kobe, they know how to get – they know how to create shots closer to the hoop. They know how to get those easy baskets. And I still feel like Durant gets pushed too far away from the basket at crunch times. It takes lower percentage shots at a time when you need some higher percentage shots. And I think that one little wrinkle, depending on how they – whether that it means Harden steps up or somebody else steps up, but that one little wrinkle is something that I often worry about, that they need to find down the stretch with Durant that I quite haven't seen him do consistently. Am I missing that?
No, you're not. You're not. It's one of the worst. You know, we talked about all the teams having worst. It's one of the worst that the Thunder has is that when they get into tight game situations, their offense deteriorates into Westbrook or Durant going one-on-one at the top of the key. And that's not going to work against good defensive teams with guys who are going to push, shove, have their hands on them. We're still trying. Durant is still in that process. He's still evolving, you know, and we don't know exactly how he's going to respond. You know, last year they were kind of hunting. They were hunting last year. This year they're the hunted. You know, last year I think they were kind of an upstart, kind of jumped on the scene. First real year as an elite team. I also think having Dallas first, it was good for them. Having Dallas first, I think, was very good for that team. Durant is going to have trouble with bigger wings. But the one thing about it is the only one he has to face is Meta. You know, we'll see if they can make it to the finals, because the Spurs don't really have a player of that caliber on the wing who can really, I think, can really manhandle him like that and push him around. You know, the Lakers do with Meta, and if Meta's out there, Meta's going to cause some problems. I think where the Thunder can alleviate a little bit of that pressure for him is when they have Westbrook and Harden on the court at the same time, because what that does is now you have, especially with a team like the Lakers or even with a team like the Spurs, is that now you have to account for both of those two players. Or even if they were to go against a team like the Heat, you know, who's way going to guard out of those two? And then where do you put LeBron? You put LeBron on Durant? Okay, now he can manhandle Durant. But then you got Chalmers on Westbrook or either Chalmers on Harden, and that's a mismatch. Okay, how you slice it, Rio on either one of those guys is a mismatch. You know, you could put Battier in there. I don't think Battier is that kind of a player. Battier is a very heady defensive player, but I don't think Battier has ever been a physical guy. He's more of a technique defender, where he's not gonna play the passing lane. He's gonna play position defense. He's gonna try to not allow you to get the ball in certain spots. And I think that's a little bit of what you're talking about. But I think what Durant has trouble with is the physicality of it and being able to bully his way into the spots he wants. It'll be interesting. I agree with you. I think he does get bullied out of spots every now and then because he is fairly thin, and that's what it boils down to. You know, if you only weigh 230 pounds and I can bench press 225 pounds 30 times, I'm going to move you pretty easy even when you are exerting force back, you know. So we're gonna see. The thing that scares me about them is that those late-game situations where they start going one-on-one, because it becomes predictable, it becomes easy to guard, and I think it's like – it's like taking Westbrook into a candy store. You know, he's a 6-year-old kid, and you take him to a candy store. And every time they do that, I feel like they're tempting him to just go nuts and stop passing the ball. And you don't want to keep doing that. You don't want to keep doing that.
Yeah, I think that's a good closing point.
Yeah. So I'm gonna leave it there. I'm gonna leave it there, and we're gonna wrap up the show. We'd like to thank our guest, Dr. Alan Sack, for joining us doing the live portion of the show. Thank Justin Page for coming on with us for the after hours section. You know, Justin Page, you know, some people want to say that he's our version of Skip Bayless. Nah, he's not. He's not our version of Skip Bayless. Skip Bayless is ESPN's version of Justin Page. All right,
that's right.
Skip is trying to do his best, Justin. All right. We appreciate Justin for coming on. He always keeps it live. He keeps it mad provocative. thanks to the other third, the other two thirds of the three man booth, PhD and D Wills for holding it down in my absence. Great teams. We're a great team. Thank you for listening, and we will check you all next week, same time, same place. You're listening to the Real Sports Guy, Renegade Radio, RSB, www.realsportsguys.com. Check us out on Facebook and Twitter. Have a blessed week, and we'll check you next Tuesday. Be on the lookout for the Greatest Hits Show coming out next Tuesday. Chance for you to catch up on some of our classic shows, some of our classic segments. If you're not familiar with us, you're a first-time listener, it's a great way to get caught up to speed. So make sure you check that out next week. We'll be joining you the week after that with more hard-hitting, provocative sports talk. NBA talk, man. This past week, trade deadline passed. A lot of small moves, no big moves, though. We've been waiting on Dwight Howard to finally figure out where he was going to wind up. Unfortunately, Dwight decided that he was going to not only stay in Orlando, but waive his opt-out option. Dumb. Extra dumb. See, this is Dwight Howard, if you're listening out there, and he's probably not, but I'm going to act as if he is. Dwight Howard, if you're listening out there, bro, come on, Big D. D12, are you kidding me? You've been talking all this jazz about, I want to go this place. I got this list. Add this team to my list. I want to go win championships. And at the end of the day, you're going to wind up staying. And not only are you going to stay, you decided that it would be best if you waived your opportunity to make as much money as possible. Now, I'm trying to figure this out. I'm really trying to understand this. You must be seriously committed to Orlando. And I get that. I can dig that. I can understand that. But why weren't you this way all along? See, this is why we don't mess with you at RSG. This is why we don't ride for you at RSG, Dwight. You just don't bring it the way you should. You're just not hardcore the way you should be. We want our seven-footers tough. We want our seven-footers stone-faced like a king. They don't rattle. We want our seven-footers to be able to score like the Admiral. You don't give us that, my man. Not only do you don't give us that, you don't got that dog in you, man. You don't got that dog in you. You know? I don't know what to make of you right now. I don't know what to make of you. But this is what I'm going to tell you, Dwight. This goes out to you, Dwight Howard.
Be a dog. We don't need no meows. We don't need no cats. We need more dogs.
We need more dogs, man. We don't need no meows. We don't need no cats. We need more dogs. So, Dwight Howard, you want to be a dog. You want to hang with the RSG crew. You got to step your game up, son. You got to step it up.